Good morning, and welcome to the December 2nd, 2025 meeting of the Colorado River Basin Regional Water Quality Board, Control Board, sorry. As Vice Chair, I will be leading today's meeting in place of Board Chair Vivian Perez, who is unable to attend today's meeting. For everyone joining us in the meeting room, please turn off or silence your cell phones. This meeting is being webcasted and recorded, so please speak clearly. This meeting is being conducted in a physical location and is also available via remote access. For people who only want to listen or watch the meeting, the board's customary website is available. For those on Zoom, you will be muted with your camera off until it is your turn to speak. The host will then unmute you and ask you to turn on your camera if you have one. When you are done speaking and the board members have completed asking questions, you will be placed on mute and your camera turned off. You can remain in the Zoom meeting until the completion of your item and then may choose to exit the meeting or continue. At the outset of the meeting, I'd just like to note that we'll be hearing several agenda items out of order today. First, we'll be moving up agenda item 10, which is an informational item presentation by the National Audubon Society on the Salton Sea Bombay Beach Wetlands Project. This is being done to accommodate the presenter's schedule constraints. Second, the board's prosecution team has also requested that agenda item 8 of the contested and discussion calendar be heard after agenda items 7 and 9. That request will also be honored. So, the plan will be to proceed as usual for agenda items 1 through 6, including adoption of the uncontested calendar. Then, we'll hear agenda item 10 on the Salton Sea Bombay Beach Wetlands Project. Next, we'll return to the contested and discussion calendar, where we'll hear agenda items 7 and 9, followed by agenda item 8. Finally, we'll proceed with the remainder of the agenda items in the regular order. So before we begin, we would like to start with the Pledge of Allegiance. May I have Director Wright lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
Good morning, all. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Before we continue, I'd like to ask the clerk to do a roll call.
Okay. Chair Perez is absent. Vice Chair Gonzalez.
Good morning, present.
Board Member Beltran Serrano.
Present.
Board Member Music.
Present.
Board Member Satin.
Present.
Board Member Wright.
Here.
Vice Chair Gonzalez, we have a quorum.
Thank you. The purpose of this public meeting is for regional board members to obtain testimony and information from concerned and affected parties within the Colorado River Basin region regarding water quality issues. We welcome hearing from the public at this meeting. Any person wishing to speak should have submitted a speaker request as described in the agenda instructions. For those items listed on today's agenda, you will make your comments at the time the item is being considered. If you wish to speak on an item that is not on the agenda, you may speak now during the public forum. Comments will generally be limited to 3 minutes. The board clerk can now identify the speakers who have submitted speaker cards for the public forum. Are there any cards, Madam Chair?
No, there is not.
Anyone? We now will move on to agenda item 3, which is the review and approval of the minutes for the board's prior meeting on November 4th. Does any board member have comments or wish to propose changes to the minutes?
Move adoption.
Second.
So can we get a roll call vote, please?
Vice Chair Gonzalez.
Aye.
Board Member Beltran Serrano.
Aye.
Board Member Music?
Aye.
Board Member Satin?
Aye.
Board Member Wright?
Aye.
Motion carries.
The board will now consider items on the uncontested calendar. All items appearing under the uncontested items calendar are acted upon by the board in one motion without discussion. There are three items on the uncontested calendar, agenda items 4 through 6. Item 4 is a rescission of the substitution order, which rescinds existing orders for various facilities and projects within the Colorado River Basin region. The affected facilities and projects include the Imperial Valley College Wastewater Treatment Plant, the Yucca Valley Laundromat Wastewater Disposal Facility, Norge Village Cleaners Wastewater Disposal Facilities, the Whole Leaf LLC Wastewater Treatment Facility, the Central Brave Agriculture Services Facility, and the Imperial Valley Bioproducts Facility. Item 5 is a waste discharge requirement order for the Salton Sea Community Service District, Salton City Lansing Avenue Wastewater Treatment Facility in Imperial County. Item 6 is a waste discharge requirement order for the Armtec Defense Products Company, Inc., facility located in Riverside County. Regarding the uncontested calendar, does any board member wish to remove either of these items from the uncontested calendar? If any member of the public wishes to remove an item from the uncontested calendar, you need to have filled out a speaker card. Madam Clerk, are there any speaker cards on these two items?
No, just the dischargers are available for questions.
Thank you. Can I get a motion on the uncontested items listed?
So moved.
A second?
Second.
Okay. Roll call vote, please.
Vice Chair Gonzalez?
Aye.
Board Member Beltran Serrano?
Aye.
Board Member Music?
Aye.
Board Member Satin?
Aye.
Board Member Wright?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Before proceeding to the contested and discussion items, the board will now hear agenda item number 10. Item 10 is Audubon Salton Sea Bombay Beach Wetlands Update. Turning to agenda item 10, the board will now hear an update on the Salton Sea Bombay Beach Wetlands Project. Here with us to give us a presentation is Lauren, I hope I don't butcher your last name, Elachi? Oh my goodness. It's a good morning so far. The Southern California Program Director with the National Audubon Society. Welcome.
Great, what is that? And should I just next slide it for? Thank you. All right, good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to present Audubon's Salton Sea and Desert Work to you all and for accommodating my schedule. I really appreciate it. My name is Lauren Elachi, and I am Audubon's Southern California Program Director. So I oversee our Salton Sea team and our broader desert work, as well as Southern California at large. Next slide, please. For over 120 years, the National Audubon Society has preserved bird habitats, conducted scientific research, influenced policymakers to enact common sense conservation laws, and engaged communities across the country to protect the natural resources upon both which birds and people depend on. Next slide. More specifically, in Southern California, we operate two nature preserves in Kern and Orange counties, and one community nature center in Los Angeles. We work across ecosystems to help protect important bird areas across the Southland through habitat conservation initiatives, public policy work, climate action campaigns, and community building efforts. Next slide. Audubon is a known nonpartisan organization and plays a unique role as a connector and convener that engages decision makers and supporters from across the political spectrum to advance high impact solutions. We understand that partnerships are essential to successful outcomes, and no single organization can do it alone. Our commitment to collaborating with federal, tribal, state, and local water users, farmers, bird lovers, and other stakeholders across California and the Colorado River Basin allows us to identify solutions that align habitat protection and restoration with improved water supplies for communities. In addition to our local presence at the sea, we have teams working in communities across the Colorado River Basin and Delta. The breadth and collective power of Audubon's engagement with all levels of decision makers is driving real and lasting change. And I mention this because, as we all know, what happens at the Salton Sea is intertwined with what is happening at the Colorado River and the decisions there. And so we work closely with our colleagues in the Saline Lakes Program and the Colorado River Program to ensure that we're coordinated across geographies. Next slide. But the focus of my presentation today will be to give you an overview on the work that Audubon has been undertaking at the Salton Sea and primarily the Bombay Beach Wetlands Project. Next slide. So Audubon has had a presence at the Salton Sea for almost 10 years. We have an amazing staff who's pictured here, who I feel really lucky to manage and work alongside. All of these folks live in the Coachella Valley and are really clued into what's going on the ground and what the needs of the communities here are. We work across all of Audubon's priorities of habitat conservation, climate action, public policy, and community building to ensure that we are serving both the birds and the people that call the Coachella Valley home to the best of our abilities. Next slide. The Salton Sea is a critical stop on the Pacific Flyway for migrating birds, which I'm sure many of you know. We conduct multiple bird surveys at the Salton Sea throughout the year. In fact, we're doing one tomorrow, which is one of the reasons why I'm here today. And Audubon itself conducts quarterly surveys for our own data collection purposes and have done so since 2016. And we are also a part of a broader initiative called the Intermountain West Shorebird Survey, which focuses on saline lakes across the western United States. The initial results of that survey effort show that the Salton Sea has the second highest number of migratory shorebirds present across the 162 sites within the study, which is only second to the Great Salt Lake in Utah. Next slide. To talk a little bit more about what exactly we have seen change at the sea in the last 10 years. During that time period, our team has looked at 5 different habitat types critical to bird species, and we actually see an increase in acreage across 4 of them. So vegetated wetlands, playa, mudflats, and mid-depth water, which makes quite a lot of sense given the Salton Sea's retreat. This is good news for many shorebirds that rely on these habitat types. However, we are seeing large decreases in deep water habitat availability at the sea. Next slide. Unsurprisingly, birds are responding to this expanded habitat. During our shoreline survey in August 2023, we counted 250,000 shorebirds in a single day, which is more than twice the previous historical shorebird count. Looking at our long-term data, we're seeing a 15% median annual increase in waterbird populations at the sea. That growth is driven largely by these shorebirds. Species like the least and western sandpipers, for example, have increased 27% every year since 2016. Next slide. To dive into this a little bit more, we are seeing species like the American avocet, the least and western sandpipers, and the northern shovelers, all of which are shorebirds that rely on shallow water, experiencing over 50% increases in their population numbers. In contrast, birds that rely on deeper water or nest on islands, such as the American white pelican or the double-crested cormorant, are declining at a more rapid pace. Next slide. And again, here you can see, relatively speaking, how these numbers compare. We are working to find ways to take advantage of the population gains through shoreline protection and wetland restoration, as you'll see in a minute. And we are actively working with the state to better understand how we can create more opportunities for deep water habitat.
Quick question.
Yes.
The second item, non-breeding, is that due to the Salton Sea?
Say that again?
You know, you show the non-breeding. Oh, yeah. Is that due to the condition of the Salton Sea that they're non-breeding? Or would we expect that to generally decline?
No, I think that's partially in connection to the Salton Sea, but it also has to do with sort of broadly across the migratory pathway, which birds are being affected earlier in their migration patterns and later in their migration patterns, and that's sort of coming to bear at the Salton Sea as they stop over. I'm not an ornithologist, so but that's how I understand it to be. It's a great question. Thank you. Anything else? Okay, next slide. So in 2020, we ran a geospatial analysis to better understand how the landscape was changing. What we found was surprising. Nearly 7,000 acres of emerging wetland habitat had taken hold across the exposed shoreline. So while we're losing that deep water habitat and, of course, dealing with major public health challenges, seeing a shrinking shoreline, we're also seeing new types of ecosystems begin to form, ones that use less water but are still creating space for life. These emerging wetlands are forming where surface water flows concentrate, groundwater discharges, or drainage water is concentrated. Next slide. As we analyzed how that landscape was changing and where birds were concentrating, we also looked for areas where we could take action. So that geospatial analysis, the one that showed 7,000 acres of emerging wetlands, is what led us to Bombay Beach. It stood out as a site with clear restoration potential, and that's exactly what we're trying to accomplish with the Bombay Beach Wetland Project. Next slide. This is a 564-acre project centered around one of those emergent wetlands and located about 1.5 miles from the community of Bombay Beach. We began work in 2020 through funding from the Bureau of Reclamation and later from the Wildlife Conservation Board. The project process proved to be such a real proof of concept that the state of for the state of California on how to do multi-beneficial projects, so much so that the Salton Sea State State Salton Sea Management Program, has become the lead for this project with Audubon as a key partner. The site is also interesting because the water source here is different from many of the other emerging wetlands. It isn't fed by ag runoff, but rather from a local water source. Next slide. Here are some images just to give you a glimpse of the various types of habitat at the Bombay Beach wetland. There are deeper and shallower water habitats for birds like the northern shoveler, and there's also habitat islands that serve species such as the ridge-raised whale. These pools are also good habitat for species like the desert pupfish. In the bottom right aerial image, you can see sort of like the surface topography with the Chocolate Mountains in the background, and then the Pacific and Ken Washes converging in the foreground, which is where the wetland is. Next slide, please. Excuse me. We have identified three key goals for the Bombay Beach project. First, we are aiming to stabilize, expand, and restore the existing wetland habitat. Second, we all know that dust suppression is a major priority around the sea and of the state, and we are working to do that through recruitment of natural vegetation. And lastly, and I think crucially, we are working to provide public access opportunities and have been holding community meetings in Bombay Beach over the course of the project to gather input on how people are interested in experiencing this space. Next slide. As I mentioned before, what makes this site unique is its water source. Most emerging wetlands around the sea are fed by agricultural runoff, but Bombay Beach wetland is different. Upstream, there are a handful of hot spring spa communities, and all of them are tapped into a native geothermal water source. They use it on their properties and then discharge that water into nearby washes, and those flows converge directly into the wetland. The reason why the water isn't just flowing into the Salton Sea is sort of twofold. One is there are shoreline berms in the area, which are naturally formed barriers made out of barnacles and sediment that hold the water back and allow it to pool. And then secondly are the clay-heavy soils in this area, so the ground really retains water rather than letting it infiltrate, which allows for shallow pools to form and persist. The result is a naturally sustained wetland system with local water, natural containment features, and low input needs, which is a powerful model for restoration in a water-scarce environment. However, these habitats are currently vulnerable to erosion from intense storms, invasion from non-native tamarisk, and groundwater level decline as the sea recedes. Another key consideration is obviously that that water availability is variable and sometimes uncertain. There is ephemeral discharge and perennial flow at the wetland, and during a normal year, it's about 3,000 to 4,000 acre feet that makes it to the playa. And during a dry year, it's closer to 20% of that, so around 760 acre feet per year. There's also perennial flow that discharges at the hot springs area that is located up the hill. It's a low temperature geothermal aquifer used by the spa and the mobile homes in the area,
And this provides a discharge to the watershed of about 3,000 feet per year that we can see, but not all of it makes it to the wetland. Arriving at the wetland, it's more like 1 to 2,000 acre feet, but it's been a little hard to estimate from year to year. Next slide. The project is being implemented on both IID and Bureau of Reclamation land. Access to the site goes through the IID parcel that you see on the left of this map, and we are working with them to coordinate both construction access and then eventual public access to the site as well. Next slide. The project, as mentioned, is currently funded through Bureau of Reclamation and the Wildlife Conservation Board, and the Salton Sea State Management Program is serving as the lead on the project. We are currently in the permitting phase of the project, and it is anticipated to begin construction either in late 2026 or early 2027. Next slide. This is just a quick snapshot of the current design of the project, though it's still very much in refinement. Access is from the upper left-hand side of the site, and there will be parking, shade structures, and potentially some viewing platforms that will be included as public amenities throughout the site, as well as topographic and habitat design, which I'll talk about now. Next slide. So the design itself works to fortify the already existing shoreline berms, so water can continue to create permanent pools and protect against storm erosion. We are also implementing what are called buns, which you see in that middle picture on the slide, which are these U-shaped sort of berm areas in the unvegetated areas to help capture excess water flow, suppress dust, and promote native vegetation growth. And as I said, we are designing a series of shaded areas, viewing platforms, and informational signage throughout the project. And this is being designed in coordination with DWR and then their subconsultant, Jacobs. Next slide. So while the Bombay Beach Wetland Project is a key one to Audubon's portfolio in the area, I also wanted to give you a quick insight into some of our other initiatives, starting with our Salton Sea Leadership Program. Next slide. This program, which had its first cohort earlier this year, is really meant to help open doors into the environmental education and justice space for members of the Coachella community. We had 13 members as part of this first cohort with classes and field trips ranging from local flora and fauna to water sampling work as well as birding trips. Next slide. Each member closed out the program with a capstone project, some of which you see here on the right. But I think what's really special to see is the impact that people are expressing through the feedback that they gave us after the cohort ended. People were expressing how this program really opened them up to new experiences and how much they really value the sea and being part of communities such as this. Next slide. And even more broadly, we are seeing a positive impact across the community. Participants are sharing knowledge with their family and friends, so much so that one of the parents wants to sign up for our next round of programs. But I wanted to draw your attention also to that last bullet point on the slide where local teachers started reaching out to us because they saw the need for this program in their community. And so we listened and won a grant to build out a curriculum for 4 high schools across the valley to use their already existing school infrastructure, such as the after-school Green Academy at Desert Mirage or the School Ecology Club at Palm Desert, to have this type of program embedded within high schools. So we've already kicked off the school year this year with activities on water budgeting and traditional ecological knowledge. And we are continuing also our leadership program with applications currently open for participants. So if you know anyone, please send them my way. Next slide. And just very quickly, we all know the Salton Sea is very important, but it is just one part of the broader California desert ecosystem where Audubon has been engaging for many years. A big part of my role, it's a relatively new role, I've only been here for 4 months, but it is to help determine and drive a new strategic plan for this bigger region and identifying where Audubon can best lead and where it can best advocate for bird conservation. Next slide. For Audubon's purposes, we define the desert as encompassing the Mojave Basin and Range, which is the darker brown at the top of that map. So that's from Owens Lake down through the Antelope Valley and to Joshua Tree. and the Sonoran Basin and Range, which is the lighter brown color in the map, which encompasses the Coachella and Imperial Valley, as well as east to the border and Blythe. What we are seeing across these arid landscapes in California are rapid declines in bird populations, primarily due to climate impacts from reduced rainfall and increasing temperatures. Studies have shown that sites in the Mojave Desert have lost almost half of their bird species richness in the last 100 years. Audubon has been involved for a decade on projects like the DRECP and supporting local partners in the desert. And when my position was created, the intent was to help steer Audubon to see where we can serve as a leader within those spaces and where our conservation priorities should be. And that's something I will be doing over the next year and would welcome further conversations and collaboration with you all to see how we could partner further. Next slide. One quick win within this work that I want to highlight is the designation of Chuckwalla National Monument in January 2025. So Audubon was a key partner in this campaign alongside many others, which has secured 2.8 million acres of land as protected public land. So as part of this effort, we worked to engage over a dozen tribal entities and hundreds of local businesses to build a broad coalition of support. I think this campaign, as well as our Sell and See work, really highlights how Audubon brings together that scientific data, public policy work, and community to preserve the spaces that we hold dear and protect the critical habitat for migratory and resident bird species. And so with that, next slide. Thank you so much for your attention, and I'm happy to answer any further questions you may have.
Thank you.
Any questions, comments?
I would recommend you reach out to the Coachella Valley Conservation Commission. They're a regional agency that administers the habitat conservation plan for the Coachella Valley, and they have a number of wetland projects they're actively investigating. I should disclose that I work for them, so that's why I'm familiar with them. But we do have quite a few properties along the northern edge of the Salton Sea, and we're going to be installing some MODIS towers there for improved data collection and whatnot, so I would encourage Audubon to maybe look into MODIS towers at their site, as well as perhaps some collaboration to see what we can do along our properties at the output of the Whitewater River Channel.
Great, awesome. Thank you so much. And I should also add that we just met with Department of Water Resources yesterday to talk about their North Lake project as well. Cool. So we're looking at that area. Great. That would be great to talk to you all.
Absolutely.
And I do want to commend you for working with the youth, because that's definitely going to, open their eyes to different fields and how they can make a difference in their community and make it a profession as well. So thank you so much for including them, and looking forward to you growing that program as well.
Thank you very much.
So thank you.
Thanks.
No one else?
Okay.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Thanks. I've only been here 4 months. I can take zero credit for the job that's happening, but I appreciate it.
Yes. Thank you.
Great. Thank you all so much. Appreciate it.
Proceeding now to the contested and discussion calendar of items for adoption, beginning with item 7. However, what I'm about to say is equally applicable to agenda items 7, 8, and 9. Each item involves an administrative civil liability complaint against a particular individual, alleging that the individual violated a previously adopted cease and desist order. These are adjudicative evidentiary hearings, the purpose of which are to hear arguments and consider evidence regarding allegations contained in each complaint. These hearings shall be conducted in accordance with the hearing procedure that accompanied each complaint. In each proceeding, the parties consisted of the board's prosecution team on one side, and on the other side, the individual or individuals against whom each complaint was issued. The latter may be referred to from time to time as respondent or discharger. For all three matters, board staff have separated functions between the advisory team and the prosecution team. The advisory team consists of Michael Plasencia, the board's executive officer, and David Lancaster, the board's counsel. The prosecution team consists of Cassandra Owens, the board's assistant executive officer, regional board staff Michael Perez, as well as the attorneys Christine Eit and David Boyers from the Office of Enforcement. In each hearing, the board will consider all relevant evidence that will assist the board in its evaluation of the allegations in the complaint and the penalty proposed by the prosecution team. The board may determine the reliability of evidence, credibility of witnesses, and weight of evidence. The parties are free to further comment on the relevance of the submitted evidence during their presentations. After each hearing is closed, the board will consider whether to adopt the proposed order as presented by the prosecution team. The board may also make changes to the proposed order, increase or reduce the proposed liability, or decline to impose any liability at all. The board may also adjourn to closed session to consider the evidence received and deliberate on a decision. All written evidence was required to be received by the applicable deadlines in the hearing procedure. If the parties use speaking notes or any visual aids illustrating previously submitted evidence with your presentation, those will be made part of the record. No other documentary evidence will be accepted into the record unless the board makes a specific ruling to allow it. In each hearing, the board will allow interested persons to address the board on the matter. I'm specifically referring to individuals who are interested in the proceeding, but not representing or testifying on behalf of the parties. Because their comments to the board are not considered evidence, interested persons will not be required to take an oath, but they will need to fill out a speaker card. If there are any interested persons, I invite them to fill out and submit that speaker card now. Each interested person will have 3 minutes to address the board, though more time may be requested. Questions from the regional board and the advisory team, responses to such questions, and discussions of procedural issues will not count against these time limits. Item 7, Administrative Civil Liability Complaint R7-2025-0021 against Christopher Heltenbrenn. With all that being said, I am now opening the hearing on Agenda Item 7, specifically the board's consideration of Administrative Civil Liability Complaint number R7-2025-0021 against respondent Christopher Heltebrand based on his alleged noncompliance with the cease and desist order number R7-2024-0030 as adopted on September 10th, 2024. I would like to incorporate my general remarks on the three administrative civil liability proceedings. Is anyone here to speak on this item?
Yes, we do have a speaker.
So is Mr. Heltebrenn here?
He is not on.
He asked for the Zoom link to participate. And we sent that to him to two different email addresses that we received from him. I am just now sending an email to both email addresses saying we are beginning your hearing now. Please log into Zoom. So he is interested in doing so. Mary, would you please let us know if he does log in subsequent to the commencement of the hearing?
Yes.
All right. And in full fairness and full disclosure, previously, I think it was Wednesday, Mr. Heltebrenn sent in an email and notifying the prosecution team, which then forwarded it to the advisory team, that he had a petition for bankruptcy, Chapter 13 bankruptcy specifically, and that his understanding was that this proceeding would need to be stayed or otherwise stopped from moving forward. Without any input from the prosecution team, the advisory team, specifically myself, looked into the matter and determined that although in many civil proceedings are automatically stayed by the filing of a bankruptcy proceeding, this one would not be. And there is a big reason, and that is because under the bankruptcy code, there is an exception for governmental actions to enforce public health and safety type regulations, and this kind of proceeding would fall under that category. So the advisory team has not recommended that the board stay or continue or take this matter off calendar. We are advising that it should remain on calendar and proceed accordingly. However, we will, should Mr. Hildebrand appear at this hearing, we will allow, he will have the opportunity to present arguments, reiterating that. My understanding is he also may intend to provide other testimony as well, should he appear. So with all that said, I just, with all that due disclosure, that is where things stand.
Any response?
We do have another speaker for that item.
For this item?
Mm-hmm. Scott McCone.
You're not going to do that yet.
Okay.
We are. The order of appearance for the public comment period will occur after the prosecution team has already made their case in chief. Okay. So, Madam Vice Chair, you may proceed.
Okay. So I've already introduced the advisory team and prosecution team. The prosecution team has submitted a proposed order and attachment A that would impose 18,195 in civil penalties, which matches the amount sought in the complaint. The proposed order also contains findings of fact and conclusions of law supporting imposition of liability. The prosecution team submitted timely briefing and evidence in support of imposing civil liability. Nothing was submitted by the respondent, nor were any written comments from the interested persons. Having received no objections from either party, all pre-hearing materials shall be included as part of the record. Each party will have 30 minutes to present their arguments and evidence, including any opening statement, main presentation, rebuttal, and/or cross-examination, and closing statement. The parties may reserve their remaining time for follow-up comments. Absent a finding of good cause by the board, the parties are limited to those witnesses identified and documents included in their pre-hearing submittals. Okay.
Excuse me, Vice Chair. The Christopher Hildebrand is on now.
Oh,
okay. Just Mr. Hildebrand, we are proceeding with the prosecution. We have already started the hearing, and we are going to allow the prosecution team to present their case in chief with the allotted time, after which you will then be allowed to participate as well.
Thank you.
Okay. I will now administer the oath to those witnesses who intend to testify on behalf of the parties. All persons intending to testify, whether in person or remotely, please raise your right hand. Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you are about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth under penalty of perjury? If so, answer, I do. Thank you. Before you testify, please state your name and whether you have taken the oath. The order of proceedings are as followed. Presentation and testimony by the prosecution team, presentation and testimony by respondent, comments from any public speakers, board member comments and discussion, and closure of the hearing. I believe now we have the prosecution team that will present.
Good morning, Vice Chair. And members of the board. My name is Cassandra Owens, and I'm the Assistant Executive Officer of the Colorado River Basin Regional Water Board. I am here today to recommend the adoption of an administrative civil liability order imposing a penalty for violating the cease and desist order that this board adopted on September 10th, 2024. The board adopted a prohibition on on-site wastewater treatment systems in the town of Yucca Valley to protect drinking water and public health. Both High Desert Water District and the Regional Water Board staff put in a considerable amount of time tracking hundreds of properties and performing outreach to those who are out of compliance with the prohibition. As a result, many property owners connected to the sewer system once it became available to them. Following progressive enforcement, the board issued cease and desist orders to property owners that remained out of compliance. Mr. Christopher Heltebrand is one of those persons who received a cease and desist order. After multiple outreach attempts to encourage Mr. Heltebrand to connect to the sewer and stop septic tank usage, the regional board issued a cease and desist order. The order required Mr. Heltebrand to cease use of the septic tank on the property and connect to the available sewer system. The final provision required full compliance with the prohibition by December 1st, 2024. More than a year has passed since the regional board issued the cease and desist order to Mr. Heltebrand, and he has not complied with any of the order's requirements. The prosecution team issued the administrative civil liability complaint to Mr. Heltebrand after consideration of the outreach made, the time that has passed since the cease and desist order's adoption, his continued refusal to comply, and the impact of the violation on the efficacy of the regulatory program's efforts to protect water quality. Pursuant to Water Code Section 13350, the prosecution team is recommending that the regional board adopt the recommended penalty amount of $18,195. The administrative civil liability's adoption is necessary to establish deterrence. Deterrence encourages the regulated community to comply with laws and regulations in the first instance before considerable resources are expended bringing formal enforcement actions. In this case, deterrence is especially critical to incentivize the many people who still remain out of compliance with the prohibition to comply. By enforcing the requirements set forth in the order, the board will also ensure that those who choose to disregard the legal requirements do not reap an economic benefit over the persons that choose to comply. A regulatory program is only as strong as its enforcement program. To ensure that the on-site wastewater treatment system prohibition achieves its goal of eliminating the threat of increased waste discharges to the critical drinking water resources, the proposed civil liability must be adopted. I now turn it over to Michael Perez, who will present testimony for the prosecution team. Thank you.
Good morning, members of the board and members of the public. I am Michael Perez, and I'm a member of the prosecution team for this case, and I have taken the oath. The prosecution team is requesting that you adopt the administrative civil liability as proposed against Christopher Heltebrand for failing to comply with the cease and desist order. The cease and desist order required Mr. Heltebrand to comply with all aspects of the Yucca Valley septic tank prohibition by December 1st, 2024. The prosecution team on this case is myself, Cassandra Owens from the Regional Board, David Boyers and Christine Eit, attorneys from the State Office of Enforcement. The subject property is located at 58758 Natoma Trail in the town of Yucca Valley. Next slide, please. In this presentation, I will be providing background for why the Yucca Valley septic tank prohibition was necessary, the adopted 2024 cease and desist order for Mr. Heltebrand. Then legal counsel Christine Eit will present the administrative civil liability complaint. the enforcement policy penalty calculation methodology, then finally the prosecution team's recommendation. Next slide, please. First, let's review why the Town of Yucca Valley septic tank prohibition was necessary. The Town of Yucca Valley's primary drinking water source is groundwater from the Warren Subbasin of the Morongo Groundwater Basin. And prior to November 2019, the principal method to dispose of wastewater was via a septic tank system. A septic tank system provides minimal wastewater treatment, and as a result, it discharges higher concentrations of nitrates and other waste to groundwater as compared to a wastewater treatment facility. The illustration here depicts a typical septic tank system and how it works. Basically, the waste from a home goes into a septic tank where the solids separated from the liquids. The liquids go on to a leach field or seepage pit. Then those liquids drain down into the groundwater system. In the town of Yucca Valley, area between 1993 through 2005, the number of homes approved for construction increased significantly. And a 2003 USGS study found that there was an increase in nitrate contamination in the Warren Subbasin and that it was a result of wastewater loading to the groundwater. This increase in nitrates poses a significant threat to public health, as it is widely known that the use of nitrate-contaminated drinking water to prepare infant formula can be harmful. To address this threat to water quality, this board adopted the Basin Plan Prohibition on May 19, 2011, to protect against these water quality issues. Next slide, please. After a significant outreach attempt to bring Mr. Hildebrand into compliance, a cease and desist order was adopted by this board on September 10, 2024. The cease and desist order required Mr. Hildebrand to submit documentation, including a cost estimate, to connect to the sewer system and decommission his septic tank by October 10, 2024, to submit a certificate of connection to the sewer system by November 11, 2024, and then to be in full compliance by December 1, 2024. And if there were any delays caused by circumstances beyond his control, he could have requested a deadline extension from the executive officer. Notably, Mr. Hildebrand made no such requests. Next slide, please. After the adoption of the cease and desist order, members of the prosecution team met via teleconference with Mr. Hildebrand and his spouse, Aline Hildebrand, on October 9, 2024. At the meeting, the Hildebrand stated that they did not own the property and do not know who owns it. The prosecution team stated to Mr. Hildebrand that public records indicated that he was still the owner of the property and that he needed to comply with the cease and desist order. And also stated that he could submit documentation proving that he was not the owner. No such documentation was submitted. Due to the noncompliance, on January 24th, 2025, the Regional Water Board staff issued Mr. Hildebrand a notice of violation to direct him to comply with the cease and desist order. Then additionally, due to noncompliance, an administrative civil liability complaint was issued to Mr. Hildebrand on September 3rd, 2025 via process server. Finally, I would like to add that I affirm that I worked on Attachment A of the penalty methodology attached to the administrative civil liability complaint and that allegations made therein are true and correct to my knowledge. Next, Christine Eight will present the administrative civil liability in more detail, which will include the methodology for the penalty amount.
Good morning, board members and members of the public. My name is Christine Eight, and I am an attorney for the prosecution team from the State Water Board Office of Enforcement. I am here today to discuss the legal basis for the administrative civil liability complaint and the factors that went into calculating the liability amount we are proposing today of $18,195. The regional board's authority to issue the CDO can be found in Water Code Section 13301, and as noted previously, this board exercised that authority and issued a cease and desist order to Mr. Hiltzebrand on September 10th, 2024. The CDO was not petitioned to the State Water Board and therefore is a final and binding order requiring the discharger to comply with the basin plan prohibition in accordance with the time schedule set forth in the order. The authority to impose a liability for failure to timely comply with the CDO can be found in Water Code Section 13350, which provides that the Regional Water Board may impose civil liability in an amount up to $5,000 for each day of violation. Here, it is undisputed that Mr. Hiltzebrand failed to comply with Provision 3 of the CDO, which is full compliance from the dates of December 1st, 2024, that's the last deadline in the CDO, to September 3rd, 2025, the date the ACL complaint was issued. That's a period of 276 days total. The question is, what is the appropriate liability amount for those violations? And I'll be talking about that in the next several slides. Next slide, please. First, I will discuss both the minimum and maximum liability amounts that could be assessed for the violation, and subsequently, I'll discuss the factors the prosecution team considered in the proposed amount with reference to the 2024 Water Quality Enforcement Policy as the prosecution team's guide for the methodology. Region Board staff, assisted by counsel, prepared a methodology analysis attached as Attachment A to the complaint. The calculated economic benefit that is included in this penalty methodology was prepared by Office of Enforcement Special Investigations Unit staff, German Myers, who is also here today and can answer questions regarding that economic benefit calculation. Next slide, please. Water Code Section 13350 states that the maximum amount that could be administered to a person is $5,000 per day of violation. The discharger was supposed to comply with the final provision of the order by December 1st, 2024. From that final due date until the day the prosecution team issued the ACL complaint, as said before, 276 days of violation accrued. Therefore, the maximum liability amount is $1.38 million. The enforcement policy states the total liability amount shall be at least 10% higher than the economic benefit. This number comes to $3,972.10. However, in this case, the Water Code statute also establishes a minimum liability amount, which supersedes this enforcement policy minimum. The minimum amount under Section 13350 for this violation is $100 a day, which comes to $27,600. Notably, Water Code Section 13350 provides that a lower liability amount may be imposed if express findings justify doing so. In this case, and as we'll discuss further, the prosecution team is suggesting that $18,195 be imposed based on express findings. This amount is below the statutory minimum, but above the economic benefit minimum. Next slide, please. Pursuant to California Water Code Section 13327, to determine the amount of civil liability, the regional board shall take into consideration factors such as the nature, circumstance, extent, and gravity of the violation, the ability to pay and continue in business, any voluntary cleanup efforts undertaken, any prior history of violations, the degree of culpability, economic benefit or savings, and other matters as justice may require. The enforcement policy sets forth a 10-step methodology to consider these statutory factors in the proposed liability amount. And this methodology is divided into three distinct parts. The first part is to look at the violation itself and set an initial liability based on the overall gravity of the violation. The second part looks at the conduct of the violator and increases or decreases that initial liability amount based on the conduct. And the third part is a final check on the total base liability to see if any additional adjustments are warranted. And the following slides are sectioned according to these three parts. The purpose of this detailed calculation is to create transparency in how you determine the appropriate liability amount and the factors that go into that determination. So in this case, even though at the end of the day, we will be recommending a reduction in penalty under the third part of the methodology, it is important to understand how we get there because you are essentially making the findings along the way about how you view the violation itself, the conduct of the violator, and other factors that may be looked into in other enforcement matters in the future. Next slide, please. Because the prosecution team is alleging a violation of the order and not the discharges that occurred from the noncompliance with the order, step one and step two are not relevant. Step three evaluates cease and desist order violations and considers the potential for harm to beneficial uses in the environment. And step three also considers the extent of deviation from applicable requirements. The options to characterize both factors range from minor to moderate to major. Here, the potential for harm was major because noncompliance with the CDO impairs the ability of your staff to protect water quality through ensuring compliance with the basin plan prohibition. Also, discharges from septic tanks present high potential for pollutants to be discharged from the property, which then presents an environmental harm to the groundwater, a source of drinking water in the area. The deviation from the requirement is major because the order's requirements were rendered ineffective by the discharger's noncompliance. And as referenced on the slide, a major potential for harm and a major deviation from the requirement results in a per-day multiplier of 0.85. That represents 85% of the statutory maximum. As previously discussed, there are 276 days of violation. 276 days of violation accrued. The enforcement policy provides that for violations that last more than 30 days, the Regional Water Board may compress the days of violation if certain express findings are made. Here, the prosecution team found that the failure to comply with the order does not result in an economic benefit that can be measured on a daily basis, and therefore the total number of days of violation warrants a compression. And in line with the method provided by the enforcement policy, the number of days are compressed to 43 days of violation. The prosecution team calculated this initial liability amount for the violation to be $182,750, as referenced on the slide. Next slide, please. So step four of the enforcement policy evaluates three things: the discharger's culpability before the violation occurred, the cleanup and cooperation efforts the discharger took after the violation occurred, and the discharger's history of violations. And these factors are given scores between 0.75 and 1.5. A 1.4 score was assigned to Mr. Heltebrand for ignoring the requirements under the prohibition before the Regional Water Board issued the cease and desist order. High Desert Water District and Regional Board staff made Mr. Heltebrand aware of the requirements through the multiple letters and outreach. Despite this outreach, the discharger still did not comply. A 1.4 score was assigned to the discharger for the lack of cleanup and cooperation with the order's requirements. After the CDO was issued, Regional Board staff sent a notice of violation letter to the discharger to inform him on the noncompliance and request that he follow the requirements of the order. Despite communication with the discharger and his wife, Aline Heltebrand, the discharger has not taken the steps to comply with the order's requirements. And finally, for history of violations, because the prosecution team does not have any record of previously adjudicated violations, a neutral score of 1 was assigned. Therefore, before any further adjustment, the prosecution team calculated the total base liability to be $358,190, as referenced on the slide. Next slide, please. Now we examine other factors to consider for the final liability amount. Step 6 considers the economic benefit of noncompliance by examining any savings or monetary gain derived from the act or omission that constitutes a violation. And here, the discharger is still required to connect to the sewer system. Therefore, the cost to connect is a delayed cost. And this amount was provided by Action Pumping based on a past cost estimate to connect for the property. Along with this assumption, monthly sewer maintenance fees are an avoided cost and are included in total economic benefit. Using the US EPA's economic benefit model program, the economic benefit of noncompliance was determined to be approximately $3,611. Under step 7 is where the regional board can adjust the liability amount if the regional board believes that the amount determined using the previous factors is inappropriate. For this to occur, express findings need to be made. Here, the prosecution team found that the liability amount of over $300,000 was inappropriate considering substantially similar ACLs issued with disproportionately lower penalty amounts. From 2012 to 2016, the Lahontan Water Board issued administrative civil liability orders to property owners in the Spalding community of Lassen, California. Similar to the ACL at hand, the Spalding ACLs were ordered based on the property owners failing to comply with cease and desist orders that required owners to connect to the sewer system or abandon their on-site wastewater disposal systems. In those cases, the Lahontan Water Board prosecution team issued complaints proposing liability amounts ranging from almost $2,000 to just over $16,000. Following the respective hearings, the Lahontan Water Board issued ACL orders in amounts ranging from $106 to up to almost $2,000. The Lahontan Water Board lowered the proposed amounts based on the owners complying with the cease and desist order before the ACL hearing. In this case, the prosecution team believes that the proposed liability amount discussed in a few moments should not be lowered because Christopher Hildebrand has still not followed any of the order's requirements before the board's meeting today. Due to the similar nature and substantially lower amount both proposed and issued to the dischargers in the Spalding cases, the prosecution team believes that the calculated liability of over $300,000 is inappropriate. Step 8 also allows for the penalty amount to be further adjusted based on a finding that the discharger is unable to pay the proposed liability. After reviewing publicly available financial information, the prosecution team based the ability to pay on the value of the property at issue, which has a 2024 assessed value of $343,084. Along with the ACL complaint, the prosecution team did issue a subpoena to the discharger subject to the Administrative Procedure Act, which requested financial documents to understand the discharger's ability to pay the proposed liability amount. A response was required by October 3rd, 2025, and the prosecution team did not receive a response to that subpoena. Following the enforcement policy, the regional board should treat the lack of response as the discharger's waiver of an ability to pay argument. As discussed in a previous slide and considered in the methodology under Step 9, the maximum liability amount is $1.3 million, and the minimum amount under Section 13350 is $27,600. And the regional board may lower the penalty amount below the minimum in accordance with Section 13350 and express findings as said prior. Here, the express findings of the similar ACLs issued in the Spalding region warrant a lower amount. And considering these factors, the prosecution team does believe that the proposed total base liability should be lowered to $18,195. This represents three times the amount estimated to connect to the sewer system taken from the past cost estimate. This amount is consistent with past similar cases while still providing a meaningful deterrent to future violations of the order. Next slide, please. The liability we are asking you to impose today is for the 276 days of violation alleged in the complaint. Mr. Hildebrand is still out of compliance and may be subject to additional penalties until the date that full compliance with the CDO is achieved. We will continue to impress upon the importance of compliance and reserve the right to bring another ACL against Mr. Hildebrand in the future for continued days of noncompliance if necessary. In light of this, the prosecution team urges you to impose the proposed administrative civil liability amount of $18,195 on Christopher Hildebrand. Mr. Hildebrand failed to comply with the cease and desist order issued by this regional board, has been out of compliance for almost a year now, and should therefore be held civilly liable for the violation. This ends our formal presentation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Before we proceed, just for the record, could you state whether or not you took the oath?
She is an attorney. She does not have to take the oath.
Okay, I just want to make sure that
I don't take the oath.
Everything was
don't
clean
you
and
make
clear.
Me take the oath.
Thank you for the clarification.
Is this the appropriate time to ask questions on the calculation of the penalties, or do we wait till the proceedings and then have board questions?
Now and later. So ask away.
Okay. You mentioned the economic benefit of $3,611. How was that calculated? And did that include the cost, the hookup that they haven't paid?
I can have staff member German Myers come up and answer that question regarding the economic benefit.
And now have you taken the oath? You're not an attorney, are you?
I'm not an attorney, no.
So have you taken the oath?
Yes, I have taken the oath.
Very good.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair and members of the board. My name is German Myers. I'm the one that performed the economic benefit analysis. Can you restate your question, please?
Yeah. It said it was $33,611. So is that just the monthly fee they would be paying if they hooked up? Or because it would seem to me it may cost more than that just to hook up, and isn't that part of the economic benefit by not paying the hook what it would cost to hook up in addition to the monthly maintenance fees?
Yes, so the economic benefit includes two components. It includes the delayed cost of connecting to the sewer system. So we're assuming, I'm assuming that it's delayed because he'll still be required to connect to the sewer system. So it is incorporated into the analysis, that delayed hookup cost, and as well, it does include those avoided sewer maintenance fees as well.
So what is the delayed hookup cost?
The delayed hookup cost, so it costs a certain amount. I think the Action pumping quote was around $6,000 to connect to the sewer system and get rid of the septic tank. So the delayed cost, it basically what the model does is it assumes that they will connect. So they will pay that $6,000, but the model takes into account certain principles like tax deductibility, time value of money, to kind of put it into present day value. So there is a cost component with connecting, but it's not going to be that full $6,000. It won't be the full amount because it's delayed and not avoided. Had it been avoided and they'll never connect, then it would be closer to that $6,000 amount.
Oh, okay. And then they mentioned the value of the property. Did they take a look and see if there's any liens against the property to see if there's really any equity there?
So I would defer that question to the attorneys here.
I'm sorry, could you repeat your question?
Yes, you gave a value of the property.
Yes.
And so my question was, did you also examine if there are any liens against the property to see if there is any equity there?
That would have been the subpoena if it was answered.
I'm sorry?
So the subpoena that we sent to the discharger, it would... that requested any information on liens for the property, and that would have been, if the discharger did respond, we would have received information based on had liens.
Member Music, so are you asking, is this an ability to pay issue, or are you asking about the economic benefit?
The first part was, no, I'm talking now about the ability to pay.
Okay.
And they said the property had a value of X. But if the liens against it are X, I wouldn't understand why you would bring up the property as an ability to pay if you have no equity in your property. So I was just wondering when she mentioned the home, I don't know if it was $324,000 or some amount, are there liens less than that so there is equity that actually has the ability to pay?
Well, Member Music, one of the important things that happened here is that when the prosecution team issued a complaint, they sent out a subpoena to Mr. Heltebrand directing him to submit documents as to that effect, you know, showing do you have assets and do you have these things.
That.
So
in other words,
and he did not respond to that.
So we don't know if there is equity or not based upon the non-response of Mr. Heltebrand.
Okay. There is. I will let you know, and I think that Mr. Heltebrand could talk to you about that when it is his turn, you know, to present his defense, is that there is, my understanding, you know, is that there is a Chapter 13 bankruptcy proceeding in the Southern District of California, and those assets are listed in his petition and addressed in that bankruptcy plan.
Okay. And so then my other question is just major potential violation, okay? Is that by not hooking up, or is that based upon you haven't hooked up and you're still using water, so you're polluting the aquifer?
Is that are you asking that to, is that a question for German, or is that a question for the attorneys?
Well, it was part of the presentation.
Analysis.
It said a violation. Is the major violation that they haven't connected, or is it that they're still using water polluting the aquifer?
In consideration of the major deviation from requirement or the potential for harm?
Potential for harm.
Potential for harm. The potential for harm, it is considered in... I'm so sorry about that. Could you ask that one more time just to make sure I understand?
So it's a potential, and it may not be actual. If there was no water usage, hypothetically, mm-hmm. there'd be no pollution. There'd be no potential. But because there is water available, there is a potential. So it's kind of a fine line. So I was just curious if that potential, major potential violation, is the fact that they're using, they're still polluting the aquifer versus just hooking up and not using any water. But
and Council, was this addressed in your attachment A to the proposed order as well as to the complaint?
Yes.
Okay.
But just to provide some more insight on what constitutes major for potential for harm, okay. In the enforcement policy, it's also the board's ability to perform their statutory regulatory functions, and this can be considered major. So that was also in the analysis, but for non-discharge violations, it's still the potential for harm to from the potential discharges of the septic tanks.
Okay, and my final question, mm-hmm. I don't question any of the calculations. I assume they're all right. But when the previous gentleman spoke and said there it would potentially cost $6,000 to hook into the system, mm-hmm. is there any part in the law that talks about reasonableness? Because you're coming out with hundreds of thousands of dollars of penalties, and then you lower it to $18,000, which is actually three times what it would cost to fix it. Mm-hmm. It just seems like the penalties are a little higher than I would anticipate from reasonableness.
Well, there is. My understanding is that there is no accounting for like the reasonable cost of compliance. If the board issued a directive, and that directive went unchallenged legally, there is a duty to comply regardless of whether or not, you know, there would be a question as to whether or not the cost of compliance would be reasonable at this point. That issue would have been raised when the order, when the board issued its original directive.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? And we can proceed with the next.
All right. Is the Mr. Heltemran still on Zoom?
Yes, he is.
I think just so we're reminded, Mr. Heltemran, you will have 30 minutes to prepare your case. You don't have to use all of it if you don't want. You can reserve time for later if you need to. But this is your time to speak and address the board, Mr. Heltemran. Anything that you may have told me and myself, the advisory team, and the prosecution team, that now is your time to raise that information to the board members. Oh, and also, before I forget, Mr. Heltemran, you weren't present when we administered the oath. Mr. Heltemran, are you on the line?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
All right. Madam Vice Chair, would you please administer an oath to Mr. Heltemran?
Yes. Mr. Heltemran, I will now administer the oath to those witnesses who intend to testify on behalf of the parties. Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you are about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth under penalty of perjury? If so, answer, I do.
I do.
Thank you.
Mr. Heltemran, you may proceed. Sorry.
Okay. Everyone can hear me, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to speak on this. I'm not sure what's going on here with my screen. Hello?
Yes.
We can still hear you.
Oh, okay. Okay, thank you. So just a few things. Obviously, I'm active duty military. For this property,
I left that property in 2010 due to orders to proceed to another duty station. At that time, nobody occupied the house. It was vacant for a little while, and then we decided that we could not afford it with a family of five. So we decided to submit for foreclosure. We submitted the foreclosure. We assumed everything was good, no issues. And then I moved around. I obviously been to multiple different duty stations. I've been deployed during that time frame up until now. So I haven't lived on that property since 2010. From my understanding, there's someone been living in that house for over a decade. I have no idea who's in that house. Obviously they're paying water, electricity, you know, whatever else they're paying for in that property. Just recently, as far as the subpoena was received, I didn't receive that. I'm not sure what address that was sent to. I haven't lived with my current wife at the moment. I haven't lived with her in over 6.5 years. So if that subpoena was sent to her address, I never received that. So I'm not sure what was in that subpoena. And like the gentleman said, I have filed bankruptcy, chapter 13, currently going through a divorce. It was reasonable. We agreed upon everything up here until recently. Now I'm trying to figure out, with a bankruptcy, I have to get a lawyer, which I can't afford a lawyer, because what she's asking for is pretty unreasonable. I will be taking custody of my son here in the next 7 months. So I'm not quite sure how I'm going to afford that on top of, you know, this liability that I'm not in compliance with, even though I'm not gaining anything from that property. I don't live there. I don't get no money. Again, have no idea who lives there. Until recently, the paperwork I received by the carrier, obviously, I did get that. That's how I got this information that this board was going. I went to military legal office to see if they can assist me. They can only assist me so much. They did find out that when we submitted the foreclosure, that for whatever reason, the bank did not go through and submit, basically finalize that foreclosure. So it basically didn't go through as far as what they found. Other than that, they really couldn't help me or represent me. So that's why I'm on here. I'm sorry, I don't have a whole lot to offer for this board, but you know, that's kind of my situation at the moment. And I am due to leave the country to get orders back to Japan next summer with my son. So I'm trying to figure all this out between getting ready to move, what's going on with this, and then obviously my divorce. It's a lot to try to figure out. Other than that, I really don't have anything else to offer at this moment. That's all I have for right now.
Okay, thank you.
Board members, you may ask questions. Again, just as you did with the prosecution team, you may ask questions of Mr. Heltebrand, and Mr. Heltebrand, you are still under oath. So,
board members,
please proceed.
Hi, Mr. Heltebrand. I'm Nancy Wright. Who's paying the loan or the house? Who's making the monthly payment, if there is one, on that house?
I haven't made a payment on that house since we submitted for the foreclosure. So nothing, there is no payment being made on that house. That's why it's listed in the foreclosure. Or not the foreclosure, sorry, excuse me, the bankruptcy.
So, well, who, is there a loan on it, a bank loan on it when it was bought? Do you?
There was, yes, ma'am.
So the bank hasn't come in and foreclosed it? You said you haven't been there since, what, 2010?
Correct, ma'am. And from my understanding, the loan has bounced back and forth to at least three or four different banks. So I don't even know what bank has that loan now.
Is that
I've been trying to figure that out.
Is there anybody else's name on the title of that house besides yours?
As far as I know, no.
What does it mean?
I'm the only one on it.
And so you don't know who's living in it. Do you believe they're paying the payment on it then?
Ma'am, I couldn't answer that. I have no idea.
Do you think they're squatters? I mean, you just don't know who's living in your home.
I have no idea, because when I foreclosed on it, I was done with it, and I was like, okay, I'm done with this house. It's no longer mine. But then somehow, again, just finding out that the foreclosure never went through, and that's kind of where I'm at right now.
So do you know how much is owed on the house?
I have no clue, because I don't get no statements, because I don't know who has the loan.
Mr. Heltebrand, this is the counsel for the advisory team. I just have one quick question.
Are you
aware of who is anyone paying the property taxes on this property?
No. As far as I know, no, sir. I know it's not me.
Okay.
5 years they take it.
When did you file for foreclosure?
That was back in, man, that was maybe two years after I left. Because we couldn't pay the rent on a home that nobody was in, plus where we were living at the time.
So when was that? What year? Like 3 years ago? 4 years ago? How long ago?
Well, in regards to what, sir?
Filing for foreclosure.
Oh, the foreclosure was years ago. Like maybe 2012, 2013, maybe.
So did you attend the meeting in October? It says Christopher and Elaine. On October.
I believe that was a telephone call, if I'm not mistaken.
And you recall what was discussed then?
We were discussing, kind of options of how do we figure out who has the loan? Why is it still in my name? Stuff like that. I even visited the San Bernardino County, the county courthouse or whatever that is up there, trying to figure out, try to get records, and it was pretty much a dead end.
Okay, thank you.
I just have a quick question out of curiosity. So,
yes, sir.
When did you, after you filed for foreclosure, was that a request to surrender title, you know, back to the bank and say, you know, here, I don't want to have anything due. And I think you said that was in 2012 or it was like several years ago, right?
Correct, sir.
When?
Yeah, the goal
mm-hmm. Go ahead.
The goal was to give it back to the bank. We were never going to come back to that just due to the nature of the military. You know, we're bouncing all over the place within the United States, overseas. So, and with my rank and my billet, I was never going to end up back in that location.
Were you aware of the board's proceeding to adopt a cease and desist order in the fall of 2024?
We were tracking and we were trying to get information, and we just between not finding anything and then obviously, you know, trying to go through this divorce and between work requirements and going overseas multiple times due to the military, I never followed up with it.
Okay, I understand. So are you saying, so you have no idea who's currently living on this property?
I have no idea, sir.
Have you made any attempt to contact them or demand payment of rent or otherwise evict them?
We looked into trying to figure out who was in that house, as far as like, was anybody paying water or paying electricity, but they wouldn't give me that. They wouldn't give me information. And then I talked to the sheriff's department in regards to, hey, if you know, there's someone obviously in that home, you know, and I have no idea who it is. And they were like, well, you have to go through different procedures, especially if they're like squatters. And from my understanding, California squatters have rights, depending, again, I'm not a lawyer, but, that's kind of what I was told at that time frame.
Excuse me, just to get me again. Do you know what bank
yes,
is
ma'am.
Holding the loan on this property?
I do not know, ma'am. I have no clue. I get no emails, no phone calls, no statements. No idea who has the loan on this house now. I can tell you who it was when I purchased the house, but it's definitely not the same. It's not the same bank.
What bank was it to begin with?
I would have to get back to you. I don't have that paperwork on me.
Well, that might be a start to find out what's going on with your house if it's still in your name. I guess my David, I have a question about this situation. If the board decides to do something, you know, like put a lien on the property, if that's when you told us about this before, I think up at Yucca Valley, and you were saying that could be the very end if things go, you know, if you don't, if things go, you know, people don't have the money, da da da. It could end up being something like that.
Yeah. If one of the things, so if the board does adopt an order imposing civil liability today, the next step would be to record that as a judgment in Superior Court. And then in connection with that judgment would then be recorded as a lien against this property.
Right. But we need to find out who has the, I guess, would we need to know that information to do that, I guess?
It would be against this property or another property that he owns.
Well, I would say it was this property. I mean, I don't know if it would be fair the other way, but
Because
then it would be paid if when the property changes hands.
Yes.
Or gets sold.
The lien
and it
would
doesn't
be
make any sense that the bank or even the county would not close it down because of lack of paying property taxes. Mm-hmm. That's 5 years, and then they'll take the house and they usually auction it off to somebody. Mm-hmm.
If the property taxes are...
5 years of property tax, yeah. So mm-hmm. it's just kind of...
That can be delayed in some cases.
Okay. Okay.
That may have come up in the bankruptcy proceeding, but that is not in the record at this time.
Okay. About the bankruptcy, we can't. What about putting it into the bankruptcy? That's not going to help get it for the state to get the money.
My interpretation is that the liability... We issued the complaint after the bankruptcy petition was filed. We were not listed as a creditor in that bankruptcy proceeding, and that I think that is if the parties are okay with, I would like to formally ask that bankruptcy petition and the materials that were emailed to the parties be formally included in the record. Basically, there were three or four bankruptcy records from the court, the case summary, the bankruptcy plan, and the petition, and the order confirming the bankruptcy plan that were sent out to the parties yesterday. Mr. Heltebrand, are you okay with us including that in the record?
Yes, sir.
All right. So that was that within those materials, the board's liability was not addressed or included in that plan.
So is the house in the bankruptcy?
Yes, it is listed. It is listed on the bankruptcy, ma'am.
David, I have a question just from a general side. Mm-hmm. It's far as setting precedent. We have two more similar cases today, you know, for failure to hook into the system. And potentially, how many more do we have in phase one and in phase two, where does our first case set a precedent on how we handle the subsequent cases as far as...
Under the enforcement policy, consistency with similar situations, I mean, as the prosecution team counsel brought up in their cases, does have a role to play in that, but it doesn't set a binding precedent. You should, and I advise you to take each case under consideration for its own facts.
Did you have something to?
The prosecution team does not object to the admission of the bankruptcy records. Thank you.
Sorry,
can you repeat that one more time, please?
I'm sorry about that. The prosecution team does not have an objection to the bankruptcy documents to be included in the record.
Thank you.
I have a question regarding the consistency with similar ACLs. So it says that the prosecution team in the Lahontan projects or complaints proposed fees up to, or I should say claims up to, what, $16,500, but the board ultimately only issued orders in the amount of around $2,000. Mm-hmm. What was the reasoning for knocking it down from, you know, I assume $16,500 to $2,000?
So those property owners, in those cases, they were issued the ACL complaints, and in between the time of the ACL complaint and the order, they complied with the prohibition.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions or comments from the board?
I mean, not that I really clear up the confusion regarding the house, but...
David, do you have any recommendations?
Well, I think I have some thoughts how to think about this case. As far as we can tell, I don't think Mr. Heltebrand was made aware that, you know, he's at least the records still show that he owned the property, despite having believed that he says that he believed that the matter had... Basically, he had kind of walked away from the property, and he was aware in tracking the cease and desist order proceeding. And I think it comes down to whether or not you thought his, you know, actions in relation to this case were reasonable based on his awareness of the facts and how you would expect people in a similar situation to act under the circumstances. And your evaluation may choose to reflect that.
About 10 minutes.
Mr. Hildebrand, can I ask when you contacted Military Legal Services to ascertain where in the foreclosure process your house was?
So I initially started when we were having a conversation, the telephone conversation that we had, I believe it was last year, and they were looking into it, and they couldn't find anything, and I was like, okay, I'll keep trying to look. And then obviously when I got this new paperwork, I went back. And, you know, just like military, you know, a lot of different people change positions. So the person I worked with before is obviously gone. So this new person I worked with, he did some digging and got with, you know, a high ranking person, and they were able to find out that the foreclosure never went through. I didn't ask them for that you know, information as far as physically, because that was just recent that they were able to dig up and find that foreclosure information. But the previous person didn't find anything.
Is it accurate to say, though, that you didn't engage with the military legal counsel until you received this board's original cease and desist order in 2024?
When that initially came out, that's when, again, that telephone, I can't remember the gentleman's name earlier when he said that he spoke to me and my wife on the phone. That's when we kind of initiated getting with, well, I did, got with legal to figure out, hey, can you help me about this foreclosure? Who owns, like, why do I still own this house? What bank owned? Like, what bank has this? And, you know, military legal, when it comes to this, they're very limited on how they can help me. And then when I got the new paperwork that was delivered to my door, that's when I re-engaged the military legal again.
Understood. Thank you.
Do we know if the water district would know if there's somebody paying the water bill and who that is? And the electric company who's paying the electric? Do we have that information?
Was there a water bill submitted in the prior proceeding? Mr. Perez?
Yes, we do have a water bill that was submitted. And
exhibit was that in the prior proceeding?
I don't know exactly. Okay. Could have been exhibit 11.
All right. Is it an exhibit in this proceeding? Okay. One sec.
I know that the water districts usually will make sure that the owner either is co-signs or not co-signs, but knows that the property is in somebody else's name, and they always keep the owner knowing what's going on with it, because the owner is at the end of the day, if renter does not pay their water bill, the owner has to pay it. The owner is the one responsible for that water bill, because water stays with property. It doesn't follow you around like Edison.
That's true, but some water districts don't enforce that. They just allow a tenant to hook up and be responsible.
Right, but oh, really? And they don't ask for the property owner at all?
Correct.
Throughout the, oh.
It's like 50-50.
What does High Desert do?
We'd have to ask High Desert what the current.
Well, let's put a pause on that.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, going back to this decision, right now we could continue the hearing. That is an option. I'm not recommending it at the time, but I'm putting that on the table. If there is a contention that Mr. Hildebrand no longer owns the property, if he no longer owns the property, if that is his contention, I don't think that was quite his contention. I think Mr. Hildebrand, feel free to correct me, but I believe your contention was that your previous understanding was that you no longer own the property, and that your assumption was that you that the bank was supposed to foreclose or at least, you know, sell the house to somebody else, and that didn't happen. Mr. Heltzebrand, is that correct?
That is correct. The intent was to get rid of the house, give it back to the bank, and just be done with it. And
but your current understanding is that no one has, the bank has not sold or taken title to that property.
According to the military legal gentleman that I spoke to, they were able to get information that the bank never followed through with that. Not sure exactly why. And he did say sometimes the bank will do that, or sometimes they will foreclose on it, and then they just don't send the proper paperwork, again, I don't know how the process works, but they never finished the process to ensure that my name came off of that house and that title.
I see. Did you use any equity in that house? Did you use that house in any loan applications since that?
No, sir.
What is your understanding of how much equity you have in that house or had in that house at the time you walked away?
At the time I walked away, I didn't think there was any equity, because at that time, that is when I believe it was when the housing market was kind of going in a downward spiral. So I didn't think there was any equity in the house, and I didn't know what the house is worth until today when they said it was $343,000.
When did you buy that house?
I bought that house back in 2000, I believe it was 2006.
Do you remember how much you paid for it?
I believe it was $250 or $260 maybe.
You got equity in it now.
Did you, well, we don't know that, remember, right?
Well, I'm just saying.
Was it like basically 100% loan, or was it a VA loan?
It was a loan.
Okay. Did you put any down money down on it, or was it just all 100%?
We put $10,000 down. I'd have to go back and look at the paperwork, but I believe it was like 10 or 15 maybe down on the house, and then everything else was a loan. Mm.
And did you take any money out of that house with
no.
another loan? Or okay, so you didn't borrow
no,
against
sir.
That? All right.
No, sir.
And did your wife leave the property at the same time you did in 2010?
Yes.
And you've separated from your wife?
Yeah, we haven't lived together since 2019.
Okay.
Yeah, I got orders to Japan and went to Japan by myself without her and my kids. That's kind of when the separation kind of began for us.
Mm-hmm. All right. So you're basically, the position is that you up until like relatively recently, you didn't realize that you still had this property, Mr. Heltzebrand, or it was still in your name.
I mean, other than what San Bernardino was telling me, like, hey, this house is still in your name. And I'm like, that has to be incorrect because of the foreclosure.
Do you still have that out of curiosity? Do you still have that application for foreclosure in your records?
I would have to go back and look to see if I have my records. I know, when we move, every 3 years we move, unfortunately, a lot of things with military, a lot of our stuff either gets damaged or gets lost. So I have to double check and see if I have those records. I know for sure I have the paperwork when I bought the house. I do have that paperwork.
Thank you, Mr. Aldebrand. I don't have any more questions, but maybe the board does.
Hey, David.
Yes, sir.
Are the fines that we potentially can issue, do they go to the property or to the individual?
They go to the property, but then they would be secured by a lien against, or they would go to the individual, but then our first recourse typically is to put the lien against this property or another property that he may own.
And the other question I have is, like in this case, it was around $18,000 was the suggested penalty. Could we have a clause in there that it could be reduced to $6,000 if they hooked up within 6 months?
Typically, like a suspended liability is not typically what the water boards do.
Typically?
Mr. Boyers will speak to that from the Office of Enforcement.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, I'm David Boyers, Assistant Chief Counsel. As to that particular question, the enforcement policy actually expressly prohibits suspension of penalties based on compliance in the future. So that is not an option. It's done judicially, but in an administrative context, the enforcement policy controls. So can I just go back just as a point of order? I know that we're deep into questions. I want to make sure that Mr. Hildebrand has the opportunity for cross-examination if he has any cross, and that we have the opportunity for cross of Mr. Hildebrand as well. I also want to ask how much time we might have left for closing argument.
What do you mean, how much time we have
left? I don't think you guys used up the same. He didn't use up even half of it, so I think he has 20 minutes left or so.
How much time we have?
You have.
And if it's fine that we don't need to worry about time,
let's say 15 minutes, or okay. 10 to 15 minutes, somewhere in that range, I think.
And if I might just use this opportunity, I have one question for Mr. Hildebrand. Mr. Hildebrand, you listed your property as an asset on your bankruptcy filing. Is that correct?
That was part of the paperwork. I had to list it on that documentation.
That's all. Thank you.
Members of the board, I have printed out those bankruptcy materials that we sent out to the parties via email yesterday. I would ask that someone on the prosecution team go retrieve them from the printer, and then we can put them in front of the board. Actually, I have some assistance in the back. Don't worry about that. Never mind. I just want to make sure that you guys can see the bankruptcy petition and the case summary, so that way you guys have considered it.
So I have a question regarding the bankruptcy. So that was filed, but it didn't include this liability as a debt on the bankruptcy? Can it be added to it, or if it put a lien on the house, that depreciates the value of the house. How does that factor in?
This would be a post-petition claim. So the idea of bankruptcy, typically in bankruptcy law, this is not my forte, but this is typically what bankruptcy is. Is it discharges claims that exist before you file. Okay. So if you incur debts after you declare for bankruptcy, especially after a plan is approved, that's not typically how it works. Okay. So you wouldn't necessarily be folded into that. This would kind of be layered on top of those other liabilities.
So what would be he named it an asset on the bankruptcy? What does that mean? That just means that he's got some money to pay off some of the.
No, you're just required to list everything you own and then all your liabilities. I mean, he could list it at $340,000, and because he hasn't made payments on his loan, his liability may be $340,000, just to get everything discharged.
After all this time, I can't imagine that paperwork just falling through. But
hey, David, if we lien the property and it's subsequently foreclosed, are we in a first position, or are we, does the mortgagee get first position?
Thank you.
I mean, could our lien be discharged in a foreclosure?
It could be because, okay, this is bar exam material here. But I believe that the mortgage would be the senior lien on the property. And so if the senior most lien, if there's a foreclosure action on the senior most lien, that basically wipes out everything, all the junior liens. And so this is, although it is a judgment lien, it is much later in time than any other loans that were taken out on the property. So my best guess is that that's, you know, if there was a foreclosure, it would be sold, you know, we would receive the proceeds of that. But there would still be a judgment against Mr. Hildebrand.
There would, okay.
Well, what if the property sells? Doesn't whoever buy it have to hook up to sewer?
Absolutely.
Well, that would be the lien that was
No. The lien is a secured asset that basically secures payment of a debt owed. So if the board were to impose civil liability, there would then be a judgment against Mr. Hildebrand in that specified amount, and that would just be the lien would be attached to his property that he owns or has title to, and then the proceeds would be paid out of that. But we would still be entitled to payment in full.
Okay.
But that is a matter of collections. Members of the board, I'm also passing out several copies to share amongst you. His petition for bankruptcy. It's a big document, so you may have to, I didn't want to print out individual copies, but, you know, review it as you find, you know, as you need to, and pass it along to anybody else who wants to see it. So there is three or four copies for the board.
Okay, so now the prosecution. They want to, thank you. So why don't we move forward? Let's move forward. I think that the prosecution do their thing.
All right. I'll let the prosecution team, you may get up and address the board.
Yeah, we do have a closing statement. I don't believe we have any further cross-examination. I want to make sure that Mr. Hildebrand has the opportunity before we move into our closing statement to do cross-examination of our witnesses.
I have one more question for Mr. Hildebrand. Before we close the hearing or before they make the closing statement, Mr. Hildebrand, if you were to be the owner, would you be able to hook up this to the septic tank? Do you intend to?
No, I'm bankruptcy, going through a divorce, which I have no idea how that's going to turn out. I'm barely making it right now. There's no way I'd be able to afford to even hook up at the moment. I mean, it's what, $5,000-$6,000 that I don't have. I mean, I don't know what other, again, I'm not sure what options are available to me in this case. And again, ultimate goal years ago, and still to this day, I want nothing to do with this house. Like, I would never move back there. I'll never get stationed there. So the goal is not to have anything to do with this house.
Prosecution team, you may begin your hold on.
Before we finish our close, I do have a couple more questions for Mr. Hildebrand. Mr. Hildebrand, you took the oath, correct? And you're under oath in your testimony today under penalty of perjury. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Did you sign a rent-to-own agreement with a Rochelle Hopper for this property?
Negative. No idea who that is.
On 2000, so if I were to present you with a document dated January 22nd, 2016, buying between you and Plaza Home Mortgage.
Okay, Rochelle, yeah, if you're talking about.
And Rochelle Hopper, the tenant, agree to a tenant relationship. Is that accurate?
Okay. That's when I bought the house, if that's the owner that I bought it off of. Is that what you're asking? Is that the owner that owned it before me?
I'm asking you the question.
I would have to go back and look at my paperwork to see if that was who I bought the house off of.
Mr. Boyers, do you have a printed copy of this document available for us to see?
I don't have a copy of any document. I'm just asking him questions.
All right.
And I'm not under oath, and I'm not testifying. I just want to make sure that that Mr. Hildebrand has not heard of a Rochelle Hopper.
Yeah, I'd have to go back and look at the initial paperwork, sir, to see if that was who I bought the house off of.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, now we're going to hear the closing arguments from the prosecution team.
This regional board adopted the cease and desist order to protect the Yucca Valley's community groundwater from and reduce the threat of nitrate loading, the threat that nitrate loading poses to human health. You heard from Mr. Hildebrand that he hasn't lived on the property since 2010. However, according to the public record, including the county's tax assessor, Mr. Hildebrand owns the land. As the legal title owner of the property, Mr. Hildebrand controls the land and the potential discharges that emanate from his property. As you heard today from the board staff, from board staff Michael Perez, any alleged confusion Mr. Hildebrand had about his ownership of the property should have been cleared up in the October of 2024 meeting, where Mr. Perez told Mr. Hildebrand that he owned the property and was thus responsible for complying with the CDO. Not much of what you heard from Mr. Hildebrand is making sense. He claims that he can't pay the property taxes on the house. He hasn't paid the property taxes on the house since 2010, but he still owns legal title to the property as exhibited, not only by the recent county tax assessor records, but also the fact the property is listed as one of his assets in the bankruptcy proceeding, which has been entered into the record. This is a mystery. But what is clear is that this responsibility to comply with the cease and desist order and to stop discharges to groundwater ultimately lies with Mr. Hildebrand as he owns the land. The prosecution team urges the board to adopt the administrative civil liability as proposed. Thank you.
Okay. The hearing on agenda item 7 is now closed.
Members of the board, I just want to put this out there that you do have the opportunity to meet in closed session to deliberate your decision in this matter. We would just simply depart to another room, and then we would adjourn. You know, once we have arrived at a decision, we would then reconvene, announce that decision, and then vote on what that would be. So
that's a good idea.
All right. And that would be pursuant to... I believe.
Do we need a motion from the board to enter into?
Sure, it wouldn't hurt. Session. So why don't you, someone move to enter closed session?
If it's the will of the board.
Excuse me, David. We do have a public speaker for this.
Oh, meeting. You know what? Let's. That's right. My mistake. Thank you, Mary. So we'll hear. The hearing is still closed, but we will hear public comments, and then we'll take a motion to meet in closed session.
Scott McComb.
Thank you. At this time, I'd like to withdraw my request to speak. Thank you. At this time, I'd like to withdraw my request to speak as my comments on items 7, 8, or 9 are not related to the septic discharge prohibition and subsequent enforcement actions. Thank you.
Thank you.
They're not related?
Yeah. Not related.
No. To the prohibition?
His comments.
His comments, so he's withdrawing his request to speak.
Yeah. All right, and actually just want to clarify, you don't need a motion. I know I always make you move and vote on things you don't need to, but so actually that is, so Madam Vice Chair, would you announce?
So we will now move into...
No, you do not need a motion.
We don't need to, but we do need to state that we are going to recess.
Yes, so the board will now take a recess, and we will reconvene in about 5 minutes in closed session. We will. How long do you think we should announce for our closed session?
Well, we should take a little break.
Ten minutes?
Okay, the board will meet in closed session between 10 and 20 minutes, yeah. After which we will reconvene here in open session.
Okay, thank you, everyone, for your patience. We have now returned from closed session. May I please have a motion regarding the adoption and issuance of the prosecution team's proposed administrative civil liability order dated November 17, 2025, imposing $18,195 in civil penalties against the respondent?
So moved.
Can I get a second?
I'll second that.
We need roll call.
Vice Chair Gonzalez?
Aye.
Board Member Beltran Serrano?
Aye.
Board Member Music?
Aye.
Board Member Satin?
Aye.
Board Member Wright?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Okay. Next item, item 9, administrative civil liability complaint.
Mm-hmm.
R7.
I think there was a request that we would actually move item 8 in front of item 9 instead.
I apologize.
Yeah, we just heard item 7. Now we are moving on to agenda item 8, or that would be the request if you are so inclined.
Sure.
And then how is the board doing on timing?
I do have to leave in about 10 minutes.
So there will not, or we will remain a quorum, but Madam Vice Chair, I suggest that you designate someone else in your stead to be acting as Vice Chair, since it is likely that you will not be here for to vote on the next agenda items.
Okay.
Oh, have I been voluntold?
Peter or else is Senna?
It's the announcer voice, right?
Peter Hogan.
Yeah. I'm happy to, yeah.
The announcer voice, yeah. Okay, so let's go. Item 8.
So what was the decision?
Peter. You want to go ahead? So that
I can just leave the item off so you can sneak off.
Yeah. Madam Vice Chair, I think if you need to leave, then if you're not going to be here for the vote.
Okay. Sounds good.
Can you pass me the script, please?
Happy holidays, everyone.
Oh, thank you. No, we're good. All right. Shifting gears. Stand by, please. What are we on? 14, thank you. Okay, thank you all for your patience. I am now opening the hearing on agenda item 8, specifically the board's consideration of administrative civil liability complaint number R7-20250023 against respondent Nancy Ann Kennedy based on their alleged noncompliance with the cease and desist order number R7-2024-0047 as adopted on December 10th, 2024. Once again, I would like to incorporate my general remarks on the three administrative civil liability proceedings.
Acting chair, you're referring to the Madam Vice or the Vice Chair's general remarks that preceded agenda item 7.
That is correct. Ms. Kennedy is present at the hearing And are you represented by anybody?
Yes, she is.
Does have representation online. All right, thank you. You can remain seated, Mrs. Kennedy. Thank you. Okay, I've already introduced the advisory team and prosecution team. The prosecution team has submitted a proposed order and attachment A that would impose a reduced sum of $3,623.40 in civil penalties, which is less than the amount originally sought in the complaint. The proposed order also contains findings of fact and conclusion of law supporting imposition of a liability. The prosecution team submitted timely briefing and evidence in support of imposing civil liability. Although the respondent did not submit anything directly to the advisory team, the representative emailed a High Desert Water District private sewer lateral inspection form dated October 30th, 2025 to the prosecution team. These materials were then forwarded to the advisory team. Both the representative's email to the prosecution team and the inspection team are included as part of the record. All pre-hearing materials, including the forwarded inspection form from the respondent's representative, shall be included as part of the record. No written comments were submitted by any interested persons. Each party will have 30 minutes to present their arguments and evidence, including any opening statement, main presentation, rebuttal and or cross-examination, and closing statement. The parties may reserve their remaining time for follow-up comments. Absent a finding of good cause by the board, the parties are limited to those witnesses identified and documents included in the pre-hearing submittals. Madam Clerk, are there any speaker cards for this agenda item from interested persons?
Just the representation for Ms. Kennedy.
All right. I will now administer the oath to those witnesses who intend to testify on behalf of the parties. All persons intending to testify, whether in person or remotely, please raise your right hand. Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you are about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth under penalty of perjury? If so, answer, I do. Thank you. Before you testify, please state your name and whether you have taken the oath. The order of proceedings are as follows. Presentation and testimony of the prosecution team. Presentation and testimony by respondents. We have no comments. Board member comments and discussion, after which I will close the hearing. So presentation by the prosecution team, please.
Again, I'm going to be doing the opening statement for the Nancy Ann Kennedy case. Good morning, board members. My name is Cassandra Owens.
Cassandra, is your mic on?
Yeah.
Okay.
Assistant Executive Officer to the Colorado River Basin Regional Water Quality Control Board. And I am here again today to recommend the adoption of an administrative civil liability order imposing liability against Nancy Kennedy for violations of the cease and desist order that the board adopted. As with the other AC administrative civil liability complaints today, before you today, this case is about ensuring that drinking water in the town and surrounding area of Yucca Valley is protected. The board adopted the prohibition, again, to on-site wastewater treatment systems in the town of Yucca Valley to protect the drinking water and public health in 2011. High Desert Water District, along with regional board staff, have put in a lot of hours tracking hundreds of properties and performing outreach to those property owners regarding compliance with the prohibition. As a result, many property owners did comply. Following progressive enforcement, the board issued cease and desist orders to property owners that remained out of compliance. Ms. Kennedy is one of those persons who received a cease and desist order. The order required that Ms. Kennedy comply with three deadlines that would culminate with her compliance with the basin plan prohibition by March 1st, 2025. Ms. Kennedy complied with the first requirement and submitted a cost estimate on January 9th, 2025, but did not connect to the sewer or decommission her septic tank by the final deadline of March 1st, 2025. Therefore, on September 3rd, 2025, I issued an administrative civil liability complaint seeking to impose just over $16,000 in liability. Following issuance of the complaint, we received notification that Ms. Kennedy had connected to the sewer system on November 3rd, 2025, and had decommissioned her septic tank. Because Ms. Kennedy is now in compliance We are recommending you adopt a reduced penalty in the amount of $3,623.40, which represents the economic benefit plus 10%. This is consistent with the State Water Board's enforcement policy, which states that to be fair to dischargers that voluntarily incur the cost of regulatory compliance, the water boards should strive to impose civil liabilities 10% greater than the economic benefit to the violator to help ensure that they are not viewed merely as a cost of doing business. We understand the discharger and members of her family are here today. We want to express our appreciation both for complying with the cease and desist order and for attending the meeting. I now turn it over to Michael Perez, who will present testimony for the prosecution team.
Good morning, members of the board and members of the public. I am Michael Perez, and I am a member of the prosecution team for this case, and I have taken the oath. The prosecution team is requesting that you adopt the administrative civil liability as proposed against Nancy Ann Kennedy for failing to comply with the cease and desist order. The cease and desist order required Ms. Kennedy to comply with all aspects of the Yucca Valley septic tank prohibition by March 1st, 2025. The prosecution team on this case is myself, Cassandra Owens from the Regional Water Board, and David Boyers and Christine Eit, attorneys from the State Board Office of Enforcement. The subject property is located at 57478 Encelia Drive in the town of Yucca Valley. Next slide, please. In this presentation, I'll be providing background for why the Yucca Valley septic tank prohibition was necessary, the adopted 2024 cease and desist order for Ms. Kennedy, then legal counsel David Boyers will present the administrative civil liability complaint, the enforcement policy penalty calculation methodology, then finally the prosecution team's recommendation. Next slide, please. First, let's review why the Town of Yucca Valley septic tank prohibition was necessary. The Town of Yucca Valley's primary drinking water source is groundwater from the Warren Subbasin of the Morongo Groundwater Basin, and prior to November 2019, the principal method to dispose of wastewater was via a septic tank system. A septic tank system provides minimal wastewater treatment, and as a result, it discharges higher concentrations of nitrates and other pollutants to groundwater as compared to a wastewater treatment facility. The illustration here depicts a typical septic system and how it works. So basically, a septic system takes the waste from a home, and then it goes into a septic tank where the liquids get separated from the solids. The liquids go on to a leach field or a seepage pit, and then those liquids seep into the groundwater. In Yucca Valley, between 1993 and 2005, the number of homes approved for construction increased significantly. And a 2003 USGS study found that there was an increase in nitrate contamination in the Warren Subbasin and that it was a result of wastewater loading to the groundwater. This increase in nitrates poses a significant threat to public health, as it is widely known that the use of nitrate-contaminated drinking water to prepare infant formula can be harmful. To address this threat, this board adopted the Basin Plan prohibition on May 19, 2011, to protect against these water quality issues. Next slide, please. After significant outreach attempts to bring Ms. Kennedy into compliance, a cease and desist order was adopted by this board on December 10, 2024. The cease and desist order required Ms. Kennedy to submit documentation, including a cost estimate, to connect to the sewer system and decommission the septic tank by January 13, 2025, to submit a certificate of connection to the sewer system by February 14, 2025, and to be in full compliance by March 1st, 2025. and if there were any delays caused by circumstances beyond Ms. Kennedy's control, she could have requested a deadline extension from our executive officer. Notably, Ms. Kennedy made no such request. Next slide, please. After the adoption of the cease and desist order on January 9th, 2025, a family member for Ms. Kennedy provided a cost estimate of the sewer connection to the prosecution team. However, Ms. Kennedy did not timely comply with the two other requirements in the cease and desist order. Due to the noncompliance, on April 2nd, 2025, Regional Water Board staff issued Ms. Kennedy a notice of violation to direct her to comply with the cease and desist order. Then additionally, due to noncompliance, an administrative civil liability complaint was issued to Ms. Kennedy on September 3rd, 2025 via process server. Following the issuance of the administrative civil liability complaint, the septic servicer for the property, Action Pumping, notified board staff that the property was connected to the sewer system and decommissioned the property's septic tank. The final certificate of inspection from the High Desert Water District showed that the property was connected and inspected on October 30th, 2025. Due to these actions, on October 30th, 2025, Ms. Kennedy became in compliance with the order. Finally, I would like to add that I affirm that I worked on the attachment A of the penalty methodology attached to the administrative civil liability complaint, and that allegations made therein are true and correct to my knowledge. Next, David Boyers will present the administrative civil liability complaint in more detail, which will include the methodology for the penalty amount.
Thank you, Michael. Good afternoon, Acting Vice Chair Satin and Honorable Board members. Again, I'm David Boyers, Assistant Chief Counsel in the State Board's Office of Enforcement, and attorney for the prosecution team in this matter. Before I launch into my slides, I want to say some of the information is going to be repetitive from the first hearing. I think it merits repeating because Ms. Kennedy is here and we want to make sure that we establish the record, so I apologize if some of this has already been said before. So as Michael said, I'm here today to discuss the legal basis for the administrative civil liability complaint and the factors that went into calculating the liability amount that we are proposing today. The Regional Board's authority to issue the underlying cease and desist order can be found in Water Code Section 13301, and as you know, this board exercised that authority and issued a cease and desist order to Ms. Kennedy on December 10th of 2024. The cease and desist order was not petitioned to the State Water Board and therefore is a final and binding order that required the discharger to comply with the basin plan in accordance with the time schedule set forth in that order. The board's authority to impose monetary liability for failure to comply with the cease and desist order can be found in Water Code Section 13350, which provides that the regional board can issue a penalty of up to $5,000 for each day of violation of the cease and desist order. In this case, it is undisputed that Ms. Kennedy failed to comply with provision number 3 of the cease and desist order, which is full compliance with the basin plan prohibition, between the dates of March 1st, 2025, which is the deadline in the cease and desist order, and September 3rd, 2025, which was the date that the ACL complaint was issued, a period of 186 days. The question before you is, what is the appropriate amount of liability for those violations? And I'll talk about that in the next several slides. Next slide. As you heard, pursuant to Water Code Section 13327, to determine the amount of a civil liability, the Regional Board shall take into consideration a number of factors, including the nature, circumstance, extent, and gravity of the violation. If the violation involves a discharge, which we don't have here, but the statute says you should consider the degree of toxicity of the discharge and whether it's susceptible to cleanup or abatement. And then with respect to the violator, the statute says you are to consider their ability to pay, the effect on their ability to continue in business, any voluntary cleanup efforts undertaken, the degree of culpability, the economic benefit or savings from the violation, and then finally, the catch-all, any other factors or any other matters as justice may require. And the enforcement policy sets forth a detailed 10-step methodology to consider these statutory factors in calculating a proposed liability. And the methodology is divided into three distinct parts. The first part looks at the violation itself and sets an initial liability amount based on the overall gravity of the violation. The second part looks at the conduct of the violator and increases or decreases the initial liability amount based on that conduct. And the third part is a final check on the total liability amount to see if additional adjustments are warranted. And again, the purpose of this detailed calculation is to create transparency in how you determine the appropriate liability amount and the factors that go into your determination. So in this case, even though at the end of the day we will be recommending a significant reduction under the third part of the methodology, it is important to understand how we get there because you are making findings along the way about how you view the violation, the conduct of the violator, and other factors that will be looked at in future enforcement cases. Next slide. Here, because the prosecution team is alleging a violation of an order, not a discharge related to that order, steps 1 and 2 of the methodology are not appropriate. Step 3 is applicable to these violations, and it considers 2 things, the potential for harm to beneficial uses and the environment, and 2, the extent of deviation from applicable requirements. And each of these is considered on a scale of either minor, moderate, or major. In this case, the prosecution team determined that the potential for harm is major because noncompliance with the cease and desist order impairs the ability of your staff to protect water quality through ensuring compliance with the basin plan. Also, discharges from septic tanks present a high potential for pollutants to be discharged from the property, which presents an environmental harm to the groundwater, which is the source of drinking water in the area. The deviation from requirements was also determined to be major, although the discharger ultimately complied, she did so 8 months past the due date in the cease and desist order and 4.5 years after the original deadline specified in the basin plan. So the order's requirements were rendered ineffective by the discharger's delayed compliance. As referenced on the slide in front of you, looking at Table 3 in the enforcement policy, a major potential for harm and a major deviation from requirements results in a per-day multiplier of 0.85. And what this means is that we start with a per-day liability set at 85% of the statutory maximum, which is $4,250. As previously discussed, Ms. Kennedy violated provision number 3 of the cease and desist order for a period of 186 days. The enforcement policy provides that for violations that last more than 30 days, the regional board may reduce the number of days of violations that warrant a penalty if certain express findings are made. One of those findings is that there is no discrete economic benefit that can be measured on a daily basis. The prosecution team agrees that this violation does not result in a discrete daily economic benefit, so the days of violation here will reduce to the maximum extent allowed under the policy, resulting in 186 days of violation being reduced to 40 days. And using the per-day factor of 0.85 for a period of 40 days results in an initial liability amount of $170,000. Next slide. Step 4 of the enforcement policy considers 3 factors related to the conduct of the violator. Number 1, the discharger's culpability before the violation occurred. Number 2, the cleanup and cooperation efforts the discharger took after the violation occurred. And 3, the discharger's history of violations. And these factors are assigned a score between 0.75 and 1.5. Here, a culpability score of 1.4 was assigned to Ms. Kennedy for not complying with the requirements of the basin plan prohibition and subsequent cease and desist order. Both the High Desert Water District and the Regional Water Board staff engaged in significant outreach efforts to get the property connected. Over a period of 4 years, at least 5 different letters were sent between the two agencies. Your staff made phone calls and even attempted to make contact in person at the property. This lengthy noncompliance necessitated the issuance of the cease and desist order. And even after the cease and desist order was issued, not all of the requirements were met by the deadlines required. A score of 1.4 here represents a 40% increase in the penalty amount. For cleanup and cooperation, a score of 1.3 was assigned. After the cease and desist order was issued on January 9th, 2025, a cost estimate to connect to the sewer system was submitted, fulfilling provision 1 of the cease and desist order. However, because compliance with the final 2 provisions of the order was not met by the required time schedule, the regional board issued a notice of violation and requested that the 2 additional order requirements be met. The property was finally connected, but not until nearly 8 months after the cease and desist order was issued. And again, over 4.5 years after the initial deadline to connect in the basin plan. And a score of 1.3 represents a 30% increase in the penalty. Finally, for history of violations, because the prosecution team does not have any record that previously adjudicated violations of previously adjudicated violations, a score of 1 was assigned. And a score of 1 is neutral, meaning that there is no adjustment to the penalty based on that factor. As required by the enforcement policy, the initial liability amount of $170,000 was multiplied by each of these factors to reveal a total base liability amount of $309,400. Next slide. Now we examine other factors to consider for the final liability amount. Step 6 considers the economic benefit of noncompliance by examining any savings or monetary gain derived from the act or omission that constitutes a violation. In this case, the economic benefit derived from the violations was determined to be $3,294. This figure takes into account the fact that the discharger connected to the sewer system on October 30th, 2025. And is the amount reflected in the proposed order submitted by the prosecution team. The costs that make up the economic benefit are the delayed costs of connecting to the sewer based on the estimate provided by Action Plumbing and the avoided sewer maintenance fees that should have been paid. At this time, I'd like to ask German Myers, who is a water resource control engineer and listed on our witness list, to come to the podium and affirm that he prepared the economic benefit calculation using the Bend model and that the findings in the proposed order are accurately reflective of his economic benefit analysis for this matter. And I think German did not take the oath, so I would ask that you administer the oath before he gives that testimony.
You do need to take the oath?
Yeah, I missed it for this agenda item.
All right. Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you are about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth under penalty of perjury? If so, answer, I do.
I do.
Awesome. Go ahead.
Yeah, my name is German Myers. Good afternoon, members of the board. I am the individual that performed the economic benefit in this case, and I affirm that it is accurate and that the analysis does reflect the updated compliance date of October 30th, 2025.
Okay. Next, under step 7, if the regional board believes the amount determined using the previous factors is inappropriate, the board can adjust that amount if express findings are made. Here, the prosecution team found that the total base liability amount of $309,400 was inappropriate, considering 2 things. 1, substantially similar ACLs issued with disproportionately lower penalty amounts by the Lahontan Water Board, and 2, Ms. Kennedy's recent compliance with the cease and desist order. With respect to the first factor, the Lahontan Water Board complaints and orders, again, in 2012, between 2012 and 2016, prosecution staff at the Lahontan Water Board issued complaints to property owners in the Spalding community in Lassen, California. Similar to this case, the Spalding complaints were issued based on property owners failing to comply with the cease and desist orders that required them to connect to the community sewer system or abandon their on-site wastewater disposal system. In the Spalding cases, the complaints proposed liability amounts ranging from $1,975 to $16,490. Following the respective hearings, the Lahontan Water Board issued ACL orders in the amounts ranging from $106 to $1,975. The Lahontan Water Board lowered the proposed amounts in those orders based on the owners complying with the cease and desist order before the ACL hearing. Notably, in one case, the Sheila Minor case, the complaint was issued for $1,975 there was no compliance, and the board adopted an order for 1975. To be consistent with the Spalding cases, the ACL complaint issued in this case reduced the proposed penalty from $309,400 to $16,095, which represents an amount that is three times the amount of the estimated cost to connect to the sewer system. Because Ms. Kennedy has connected to the sewer and is now in full compliance with the cease and desist order, the prosecution team is recommending a further reduction under this factor, which is also consistent with the Spalding cases. Specifically, we are recommending that you impose a penalty equal to the economic benefit plus 10%. Moving to step 8. Step 8 allows for the penalty amount to be further adjusted based on a finding that the discharger is unable to pay the proposed liability. After reviewing publicly available information, the prosecution team believes the discharger does have the ability to pay the proposed liability amount based on the value of the property at issue, which has a 2024 assessed value of $106,046. Pardon me. Along with the ACL complaint, the prosecution team issued a subpoena seeking financial records that would be needed to do a full analysis of the discharger's ability to pay. No records were provided, and as provided by the enforcement policy, the regional board should treat the lack of a response as a waiver of the right to make an ability to pay argument. Finally, step 9 of the methodology looks at the statutory maximum and minimum amounts to ensure that the penalty fits within that range. Here, the statutory maximum penalty is $930,000, based on the full 186 days of violation at the statutory maximum penalty of $5,000 per day. There is also a statutory minimum amount under Section 13350 of the Water Code of $100 a day. Again, assuming 186 days of violation, that statutory minimum amount is $18,600. This minimum amount, however, is not mandatory. The statute allows you to impose a lower amount if you make findings setting forth the reasons for reducing the liability further. We're recommending that you find that because the discharger has come into compliance with the cease and desist order, a reduction below that statutory minimum is warranted. Again, our recommendation is that you impose the economic benefit amount plus 10%. Next slide, and final slide. Prior to the hearing today, the prosecution team submitted a proposed order recommending adoption of a liability amount in the amount of $3,623.40, with findings of fact and conclusions of law that support imposing liability in that amount. We recommend that you adopt that proposed order. This concludes the presentation today. I would like to thank you for your time listening to what was a lot of repetitive background on the enforcement policy. Again, we'd like to thank Ms. Kennedy for being here today, for complying with the order, and for representing herself in person. Myself and other members of the prosecution team would be happy to answer any questions you have. Thank you.
Any questions for the prosecution team?
Yes. Can you go over what you mentioned about the Lahontan Board and the dollar amounts they...
Sure. There's a lot there.
Clarify that.
How much detail do you want?
No, I just want to know the min and max before their adjustments, what was recommended, and then the min and max, ended up charging.
Okay. I'd have to mine them for the minimum and maximums. I don't have that information. I mean, it's in evidence, but I just don't have it on the top of my head. So it would take me a few minutes to go through and find what the minimum and maximums were.
It says it was from $1,975 to $16,490.
Okay.
And the actual amounts were $106 to $1,975. So no one paid as much as what is currently in front of us in our region.
Yes, and my apologies for not understanding the nature of your question. I thought you were asking about what the statutory maximum and minimums were in that case. Yes, you are correct that the $1,975 and $16,490 were the initial proposed liability amounts. In those cases, I think there are six before you. Five of them all came into compliance with the cease and desist order prior to the hearing date. Mm-hmm. the reduced liability amount in those cases, or for at least the Johnson and Ormachea cases, as I understand it, reflect the economic benefit amount plus 10%. In those cases, the economic benefit amount, I think, was calculated just on the delayed cost of compliance. There was no sewer assessment fees that were included in the economic benefit for those cases, which is different than this case, in which we do have sewer fees that are included. I don't know why in those cases there were no sewer fees in the economic benefit analysis. I think we've done it correctly in this case. But that reflects why those cases are so much less than the one before you today, is the economic benefit calculation was so different. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Thank you.
Any additional questions for the prosecution team at this time? Okay, thank you. All right, well, we'll now hear any presentation and testimony by the respondent, Ms. Kennedy and or your representative.
Okay, I don't think this will take too long. I just, first of all, I just wanted to thank the board and Mike Perez for helping us, letting us know what was going on, because I have trouble reading and I didn't, whatever. But thank you very much, Mike, for your help. And we do have it hooked up. I wanted to have it hooked up the whole time. I was hoping in the beginning that I could get some funds that would help me, but that didn't work out. We were told at one time that that they had run out of money, and that this was with Yucca Water, and that they were hoping to get some more. So that's the first reason I waited. And then after that, when I knew that I needed to get it done, I just didn't have the money. I was trying to figure out how I was going to get that down, the down payment for Action Plumbing. But anyways, I just do, and also too, we had to pay for the Joshua tree. I mean, they didn't tear it down. I think it was 40 foot from the Joshua tree, but you know the laws. If it's too close to the tree, they make you pay this $1,000 or whatever. But anyways, I'm gonna pay my $250 a month. I don't quite know how I'm gonna do it, but I'm gonna do it. And I'm glad I'm connected. And I'm going to thank all you guys for your help. I think my granddaughter was going to talk, but
for the record, could you just please state your name?
Oh, I'm so sorry. Nancy Kennedy.
And you took the oath, correct?
Yes, I did.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm sorry. Okay. Is Davian coming on, I wonder?
Is there anybody on the Zoom call that would like to speak that has submitted their name?
Yes. Okay.
What did you pay to hook up? How much was it?
It was, well, the down was, I think, $1,200 that we had to put down. And then it's $250 a month. What is?
$5,000. It was almost $6,000.
Yeah, it wasn't really that bad. But
thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Kennedy.
Okay. Next, Davine Cognard.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Great.
And so before you start, can you please state your name and whether you've taken the oath?
Yes, my name is Davine Conyard, and I have taken the oath.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, members of the board. I am the power of attorney for Nancy Kennedy and her granddaughter. And I first want to thank you for this opportunity and working with our family already. Nancy Kennedy did desire this whole time to try to meet the deadlines and comply with the order to hook up to the sewer. Once we received that initial quote back in August of 2020, that came in at $2,850. She didn't have the funds to pay for that outright then. And as she said, she was hoping to qualify for programs to assist her with that. But at that time, she started to save each month. Unfortunately, in July of 2021, she lost her daughter who lived with her. And the money that she had been saving for the sewer went to pay for her daughter's funeral. Her daughter had a daughter of her own, so Nancy's granddaughter, who lives with her, who has mental and physical challenges that limit her ability to live independently. So it's been a very difficult time for her since 2021, and she's just been trying to survive. And unfortunately, the paperwork that was coming in, she was very confused about what the documents were. What was required of her. But at the end of 2024, we worked with Mr. Michael Perez, who was very, very helpful. And in January, we obtained a new quote from Action Pumping, but that new amount came in at $5,365, which was substantially more than the first quote. And we weren't prepared for that much higher amount. And so we weren't able to meet that March 2025 deadline. Thankfully, we worked with Action Pumping and she was able to obtain a personal loan so she could pay that $5,365. But that does mean that it'll be another $250 monthly payment for her. So we were thankful that we were able to fully hook up in October 30th. And so we are respectfully asking for your consideration of financial forgiveness or reduction of the outstanding civil liability. Nancy is experiencing and has been experiencing financial hardship. Her income is limited to just her Social Security and a very small pension, amounting to a total of $2,415 a month. And her bills, her mortgage, utilities, this new payment to Action Pumping amounts to $1,753. Which only leaves her with $662 a month to pay for food or anything extra that might pop up for her and her granddaughter. So this additional bill would cause severe difficulty and just take from the money that she has for food. We do apologize for not being able to have met the deadlines years before. And we are just kindly asking the board to consider forgiving the balance or offering a reduced amount. We thank you so much for your time in considering this request and your commitment to compassion and fairness.
Thank you, Ms. Conyard. Is there anybody else for the respondent?
No, there is not.
Thank you. Any questions for the respondent? I just have one, Ms. Conyard. When did you apply for the loan from Action Plumbing? When did you initiate that process?
We initiated it right after we got the quote from them. We were trying to come up with some other options just so she wouldn't have this additional payment. So we started that conversation with them in October when we had set the appointment for them to come out.
October of 25.
Correct. Sorry. Okay. Yes.
And how long is the loan term?
It is 4 years.
Thank you. Additional questions? Okay. We will move on to board member comments and discussion. All right. Can we adjourn? I guess we don't adjourn.
Yes,
but...
yes, we may take a brief recess and meet in closed session. Do you expect that it'll take as long as last time?
I should think 10
All right,
15 then
minutes. We'll be back in 15 minutes. We'll meet in closed session.
Thank you all. You all for your patience. So to continue the hearing, I guess we have a question for the prosecution team. The board is inclined to find zero liability. Is the team willing to dismiss the claim?
The dismissal of the complaint.
Complaint, yeah.
Ask for 5 minutes to have an internal discussion. Is that okay?
Okay.
Yes, please be advised that I will have to leave at 2 p.m. in 20 minutes.
And that's when we lose our quorum.
Fair. Okay. We have a proposal for the next one, which, if with your indulgence, would take less than 10 minutes. So let's give us five. We'll come back, and then okay. Maybe we can get through them.
Thank you. All right, we've got prosecution team back.
Oh, Marin. Oh, she's north.
Yes, thank you for the indulgence with 5 minutes. In speaking with Assistant Executive Officer Cassandra Owens, she did indicate she is willing to withdraw the complaint, which would essentially take your role out of this. There would be no pending matter before you. I do want to say a few things. When we issued the complaint in this matter, we had not heard anything from Ms. Kennedy. So all of the information that came out after the complaint was issued, including compliance, including the issues with related to her care of children and the hardships that she explained today, were all unknown to us. And so we brought this complaint to you because it was already issued, because it was already out there in the public eye, and we didn't feel comfortable withdrawing it at that period in time. We do feel comfortable now having your input. I also want to add that the what was presented today, those were exceptional circumstances, and I want to make sure that the regulated public understands that these are exceptional circumstances. And that future cases are not going to be influenced by this decision. We will take every case as it comes, and our opinion is that administrative civil liability is necessary in the vast majority of cases where there is noncompliance, both to create a specific deterrent and a general deterrent, that is, for the person who's in violation and for the regulated community as a whole. So with that, if you need anything else from us, I think we can have a statement on the record from Ms. Owens that she has withdrawn the complaint, or you can take my statement, and that could be enough. Thank you.
Okay. Again, I'm Cassandra Owens, and I'm the Assistant Executive Officer of the Regional Board here. We'd like to formally withdraw our complaint for Ms. Nancy Kennedy based on the information that we've received here in the hearing today. Thank you for your cooperation.
Thank you to the prosecution team. And I would certainly like to echo Mr. Boyer's comments that for the regulated public, it is of the utmost importance that you submit your testimony to the or your evidence to these hearings so that the board can weigh it in an appropriate and timely manner. But we do appreciate the respondents' attendance today at this meeting, including virtually, to inform us of their circumstances. And we thank you for coming into compliance, if even a little late. Thank you so much.
Regarding the next agenda item, For agenda item 9, is the respondent available participating?
No, there is no one on.
Does the prosecution team feel that it could perhaps finish its proceeding? Okay. So that no continuance, I'm not recommending a continuance.
Okay. And just to wrap up the last item, whereas for the record, there is no liability is being assessed.
The complaint has been withdrawn. We have not made a determination on the record
by the respondent. Thank you. Just to confirm. All right. Sorry. So we're doing 10?
Yes, please. No. Agenda, please. Agenda item 9.
9. Sorry. Thank you. All right. I'm sorry. What are we doing? Page 11. Okay. As previously discussed, we are hearing agenda item 8 last. So we're skipping agenda 9. Hearing administrative civil liability complaint number R7-2025-0022 against respondent Pedro Luna based on his alleged noncompliance with cease and desist order number R7-2024-0031 as adopted on September 10th, 2024. Once again, I would like to incorporate the former vice chair's general remarks on three administrative civil liability proceedings. Mr. Luna is not present at the hearing today, nor is there any representation on behalf of Mr. Luna. I've already introduced the advisory team and the prosecution team. Prosecution team has submitted a proposed order and attachment A that would impose $18,195 in civil penalties, which matches the amount sought in the complaint. The proposed order also contains findings of fact and conclusions of law supporting impositions of liability. The prosecution team submitted timely briefing and evidence in support of imposing civil liability. Nothing was submitted by the respondent, nor were any written comments received from interested persons. Having received no objections from either party, all pre-hearing materials shall be included as part of this record. Each party will have 30 minutes to present their arguments and evidence, including any opening statements, main presentation, rebuttal, and or cross-examination, and closing statement. The parties may reserve their remaining time for follow-up comments. Absent a finding of good cause by the board, the parties are limited to those witnesses identified and documents included in their pre-hearing submittals. Madam Clerk, are there any speaker cards for this agenda item from interested persons?
No, there is not.
I will now administer the oath to those witnesses who intend to testify on behalf of the parties. All persons intending to testify, whether in person or remotely, please raise your right hand. Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you are about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth under penalty of perjury? If so, answer, I do. Thank you. Before you testify, please state your name and whether you have taken the oath. The order of proceedings are as follows. Presentation and testimony by the prosecution team. Presentation and testimony by the respondent, if any. We have no comments from public speakers, followed by board member comments and discussion, after which I will close the hearing. All right. Prosecution team, you're up.
Good afternoon, board members. My name is Christy Knight, attorney for the prosecution team from the State Water Board Office of Enforcement. The ACL complaint issued to Mr. Luna is almost entirely identical to the ACL complaint issued to Mr. Hildebrand. The proposed order for Mr. Luna includes the same recommendation of the adoption of $18,195 for this administrative civil liability. All the information needed to make the findings in the proposed order are already in the record, given the similarities, rather than doing the same presentation, we are recommending that we just answer any questions you may have. Before that, I'd just like to point out the major differences. First, the major difference from Mr. Hildebrand's ACL and Mr. Luna is that Mr. Luna did not engage at all with the regional board staff or the prosecution team. Also, the economic benefit is a different calculated number, and the property value for Mr. Luna is different from the property value of Mr. Hildebrand. And I'd also like to point out for the property value, under Step 8 of the proposed order's methodology ability to pay analysis, there is a typographical error that lists the 2024 assessed property value as $103,164. Consistent with the evidence in the record, the opening brief, and the annotated attachment A, the value should be corrected to $105,227. Thank you.
Any questions for the prosecution? Hearing none. There is no one from the respondents team. Okie doke. Any comments or discussion? All right. I will close the hearing. Now closed. May I please have a motion regarding the adoption and issuance of the prosecution team's proposed administrative civil liability order dated November 17th, 2025, imposing $18,195 in civil penalties against the respondent?
Subject to the changes made identified by prosecution. Yeah. Subject to the changes identified by prosecution team counsel.
Correct.
Okay, I'll so move.
Can I get a second?
Second.
Roll call vote, please.
Board Member Beltran Serrano?
Aye.
Board Member Music?
Aye.
Board Member Satin?
Aye.
Board Member Wright?
Aye.
Motion carries.
All right, thank you. And thank you to the prosecution team, both those local and far-flung, for your work today. Where am I now?
Peter, I'll take over.
Okay. Let me get you to the right page.
Wait, I'll wait a minute while you get out and these guys. 17.
Thank you.
Okay.
What's this?
Oh, I don't need it now.
Okay.
I think it's pretty easy from here on out. Item number 11. Oh, there you go. Report from Executive Officer Michael Placentia.
Yeah, thank you. Good afternoon.
Now that Peter is gone, we have lost our quorum, but since we have no longer have any action items, I think one of you three will now have to preside over this incomplete quorum but information item meeting. Okay.
I am the acting.
All right, you're now acting Chair Wright.
I am.
Acting Chair Wright, members of the board and members of the public, I am Michael Placentia, the executive officer. You have my written report in your binders, but I would like to highlight a few items. First, during the month of October, staff sampled conditions at the New River and at four sites at the Salton Sea Species Conservation Habitats. Water samples were taken to be analyzed for multiple pollutants, including bacteria, nutrients, and pesticides. Sample results are used to diagnose the health of these water bodies, determine the success of implementation programs, and to support basin planning projects such as total maximum daily load development. It is my pleasure to report that the Imperial Irrigation District has completed their Supplemental Environmental Project, or SEP, as contained in the stipulated order dated September 14, 2021, which had a total liability of $549,000. The stipulated order addressed violations at the Grass Carp Hatchery and El Centro Generating Station facilities. The SEP was proposed by the Imperial County Public Health Department, Environmental Health Division, and required the installation of 25 point-of-entry systems, which provide clean water to residences and maintain these systems for 2 years. The project ultimately installed 26 of these systems, and the project manager has submitted their final progress report and certification of completion. I only have one other item to share with the board today, and that is the recognition of our Assistant Executive Officer, Cassandra Owens. For over 25 years, Cassandra has, and I'll just point out at the outset of this, Cassandra was adamant that she not be recognized in any formal manner, but I do want to just take a moment, certainly in my purview, to recognize her contribution here to the board for these many years. For over 26 years, Cassandra has consistently demonstrated integrity, commitment, and unwavering professionalism, setting the highest standard for us all. The profound positive impact of her tireless work is visible throughout our organization, a testament to her deep care and effort. You leave an inspiring legacy of achievement, extraordinary dedication to public service, and are a role model for all of us to follow and learn from. As you embark on this new chapter, please know your service will be remembered and deeply appreciated. We wish you an enjoyable, healthy, and well-deserved retirement filled with happiness and rest, and thank you.
Yes, we do. Thank you very much. Can we maybe take that to the next meeting and vote on something like that, like something for her? No.
Against her wishes.
Well, we usually do it that
way. In absentia?
Yeah, we'll honor her in absentia involuntarily.
I serve at the pleasure of the board.
Okay, well, Cassandra's saying no, but, you know, she won't be here in February.
We can construct a shrine or do something.
I think it should be said in public, too. I mean, at a meeting when, you know, more so. So maybe in February if you want.
Absolutely. We can entertain that. Right, Cassandra?
Yeah, we're going to miss you, and thank you for coming today. I know you really didn't have to, but aren't you glad you did now?
Thank you.
Well, you're going to be missed. So don't forget about us. Come on in and see us once in a while.
Thank you very much. I want to say it's an absolute pleasure working with you, Cassandra. And, I really wish you the best days to come now that you're in retirement. But it was an absolute pleasure. And, I really enjoyed every interaction we've had.
Thank you. Thank you, Cassandra. You've done real good for our district. I bet you're glad to get out of L.A.
You know, I just want to say that it has been my pleasure to serve you here. The staff that you have here work really hard, and we've tried to reach perfection, which always pushes everyone. I appreciate your support, the staff support, and the support from the Office of Enforcement. I have really leaned on those guys hard, especially for the work that we're doing up in Yucca Valley. Today, we have three lawyers here supporting us, and they have been doing that for 3-4 years now in order for us to get to this point. It's a great project, and I'm going to be watching because I'd like to see it continue. Thank you.
Thank you for your leadership. You are definitely an asset to this organization, and we're going to miss you.
Thank you.
Yes. So if you ever want to come back, just let us know. No. Thank you, Michael. Next on the agenda is the board members' comments. You too? We don't have anybody left. Anyway, I would just like to say happy holidays coming up, and we won't be seeing you guys till February, or won't be in this boardroom till February, so it's a long time. But have fun during the holidays, but be safe.
Mm-hmm. And no additional, and for the final agenda item, no closed sessions under agenda item 14.
Okay.
So.
And I don't think we have any suggestions for any future board meetings, right?
No,
not you? Okay. All said and done, I will adjourn this meeting. Adjourn at what time? Where are we at? 10?
2 p.m. sharp.
2 o'clock? 2 o'clock.